101 WRIF, WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Jalene Jordan has the night off, so it's just you and me. Actually, it's not you and me. It's our co-producer and phone screener, Roger. So it's Roger and me, right? Peter Werby and Roger. So, you can give us a call. This is a phone-in talk show. We talk about the issues of the day, and I set some stories out. Someone says, what about your voice, Pete? What is happening? How the hell did I pick up a cold in June? I mentioned that to somebody, and they said, there are so many colds around. What's happening to our immune system? I thought mine was tough, rough. You know, immune, if you will, but what the hell? It's not laying me low, at least. So you help out by calling in to 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. When the lines are filled, or if you're bashful, you can always email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And make them short. Jalene checks those out on another computer, so I've got to do all of this. So it's good if it really has to be short tonight. Now, I wanted to, pardon me, here's something from Steve. He wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and this was last week, Monday, so it was after the show. He said, Peter, I've been listening to your show for many years now, and I've enjoyed it very much up until last night, which was May 31st, when you claimed to have control over the show, and I heard, what do you mean claim, Steve? I have control over the show. He says, I heard 1 hour, 50 minutes of gay marriage and 10 minutes on jobs. You started out okay, but then nothing but gay marriage for the rest of the show, except one UAW worker that called towards the end. Now, you speak about right-wingers and wedge issues. We all know what wedge issues are, right? These are issues that gets everybody upset, but doesn't really go to, I mean, they're important, but they'll split people apart. Like you could have, I mean, it's the way that some people will vote for, you know, right-wing conservative candidates because of things like like abortion or like gun control or something like that. And so they wind up for, voting for the party of the ultra-rich over this issue. I mean, that's a whole other thing. But let me just go on with Steve's letter. He says, now you speak about right-wingers and wedge issues, and your show sounded like the one big wedge issue last night. And I think what, am I going to be able to do the show? Do I have some music handy? But so, yeah, get going here. Get me on... I get you on the air at 313-298-WRIF. What he means, I think, is that when we're talking about the economy, we're talking about jobs, we're talking about layoffs and stuff like that, if you start talking about abortion, that splits people apart. That's the argument, I think, here. This isn't the first time you've done this, and I would like to know why. With the state of the economy and GM going bankrupt today, tens of thousands more jobs are to be lost. I just don't understand why you would waste a whole other show on gay marriage. Still, love the show and would like to hear on the air a response. Well, it's my show. It's Jillian's show when she's here as well, both of ours. And yet, you can control it, you, Steve, or anyone listening. You bring up whatever you want. It's not like I'm pulling anybody's chain about gay marriage and think, oh, well, this will get us good ratings or something like that. This is an issue that's confronting all of us. This is a monumental change in our lifetime, much in the way in our parents' or grandparents' lives civil rights was. And as we said last week, 1967, 1947, finally the Supreme Court held that it was illegal to forbid marriages, as 17 states had, between blacks and whites. I mean, so that's how, you know, not so far in the distant future, 42 years. Well, I guess that is almost half a century. But in any event, it also has to do with a mindset, I think. If you have intolerance, if you have prejudices, it's hard for you to think creatively in other areas as well. So I think things like gay marriage, you may have religious objections to it, you may have some ethical or aesthetic objection to it. Usually with guys, it's guys objecting to guys. They usually don't have a problem with women. But what's important here is an attitude of tolerance. So it's not an issue. You can say, you know what? I don't agree with it. I don't like the idea of it. I don't, whatever. But that's the key word there, whatever. Because you're not going to let it be a diversion from dealing with the economy, from dealing with jobs, from dealing with how do we make sense of the world in which we live, which is seems to be rapidly unraveling, right? So so I agree to some extent, pardon me, Steve, that that it is a wedge issue in the sense that it splits people apart. People that might, I mean, there is a continuity between a lot of people, between the right wing. They're opposed to abortion. They want the state to intervene in the reproductive rights of a woman. They want to have their view of theology and biology totalized. So they are totalitarians. So whether women agree with them or not, their perception of birth and fetuses and an entity ceases being a fetus, a dependent part of the woman, and enters full humanhood, which is then protected by law. I mean, there's disagreement with that. Well, for now, we probably should just tuck it away and deal with the issues that that are confronting us in our communities, our families, everywhere. However, it is the right wing who continues this to the point where you have the ragged edge of it carrying out assassinations. So you have a situation, and this is extraordinarily important, that you have the right wing in its demand for compulsory pregnancy, whether a woman wants to or not, to have no choice whatsoever, that they have succeeded by terror. They have succeeded by calumny. That's a big word for saying, you know, like insult and just egregious egregious insult, let's say. So they, you know, they would call doctors that are performing perfectly legal medical acts baby killers. They call women murderers. They call fetuses babies and children, which has absolutely no basis in law whatsoever. And plus, they have succeeded by the terror of assassination and fear of bodily harm on the part of physicians who would carry this out, to the point now that there's only a handful of remaining doctors in the United States that would even conceive of taking that aspect of medical practice. Steve's probably thinking, wait a minute, he's off on it again. Well, I am, and that's why. And part of it is, when you have the right wing who involves itself in terror, in assassination, and attempt to repress people by violent means, you'll see these same people opposing those of us that are trying to secure peace and social justice as well. So that's why I think it's important to continue to bring that up. Also, these are people in our community that are our friends, our relatives, our neighbors, whoever, gay people, who deserve the same rights as everyone else. And how dare anyone in the 21st century still try to deny people that right, even though you don't like it. I mean, it ain't nobody's business but theirs. So get out of their business and get to our business, which is, what are we going to do about the world we live in? No one is going to be hurt by gays or gay marriages or anything gay at all. And no one's ever been able to bring up to me any way anyone else is harmed. If you think it's a religious sin, good. Then they're sinners. They're going to hell. Whatever. You know, they'll get their divine punishment. Although I thought the Christian God was a God of love, but whatever. You got to follow the rules, too, I guess. So that's important in and of itself. The other point is that you, the listener, can bring up any subject at any time. And the fact that, maybe Steve would say, I should have said, all right, I don't want to talk about this. This is a diversion. I only want to talk about jobs and social justice. The problem is, and the reason that we don't talk about economic justice and economic solutions is most of us don't have a lot to say. I mean, are there a lot of us who think, oh, this is terrific that Barack Obama, following in the footsteps of George Bush, is handing away hundreds of billions of dollars of our tax dollars to the people that screwed us up, screwed the whole economy up, pardon me, and screwed us up as well. We didn't do anything wrong. Remember that. We didn't do anything wrong. We worked hard. We did our jobs. We did what we were told. We carried out their orders. But that wasn't all that it was about. It wasn't about us providing goods and services and labor and what have you. It was about them having these financial schemes that were enriching them at the same time that most of our wages were remaining stagnant or even declining. They were the smartest guys in the world. They had all these financial instruments that no one could make any sense of whatsoever. They pushed people into loans and just giggled about how well they were doing and couldn't have cared less what was people's eventual ability to pay those, like home loans, for instance. And now it's all crashing down around them. And so what are we going to do? What are we going to do? They created the mess. They created the mess, and we're supposed to bail them out. The other option is not bail them out, right? And what's that option all about? What happens then if we allow these people that screwed up General Motors or Chrysler or these big financial firms to collapse like the, quote, free market would allow? What happens then to our jobs and our families and our communities? So they've got us over a real barrel, and we've got to think of some options. And I'll tell you, I'm not filled with, all talk show hosts are supposed to be the smartest guys in the world that have all the solutions and all the answers to everything. Well, anyone that tells you that, just back away from them real quickly, okay? Because they're dangerous. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to propose. And I suspect most of you don't either. So that's why it's pretty easy to talk about other subjects, even though those other subjects are important. In any event, that's what I have to say to begin with. But call on that, call on anything else. 313-298-WRIF. I thought, they have these medicines you're supposed to take care of. How come it's not doing me better? You know, don't you, that, let's see, what's the date here? June 12th. If you don't have digital, you ain't watching television. Ahead of that, my wife and I got cable. Imagine that just recently, within the last 4 or 5 months. That's a pretty addictive deal because I probably have watched, I always used to brag, I never watch any television whatsoever. Well, now with a big screen, I mean, it's not that big. What is it? 32, I guess, 32-inch. We got it in a small room, so, and we're pretty close to it, so it's big enough. But the quality of the picture, the availability of programming, although still about 90% of it sucks, it isn't even worth sitting in front of, in my estimation, it is an allure. Well, a lot of poor people, a lot of rural poor, a lot of urban poor are suddenly going to have their television go blank. Because it's just not going to be there. The government has spent a couple billion dollars trying to help people out, but they're apparently, what would that be? Almost 12 million households have television sets that are either completely or partly unprepared. I think some of them are probably ones that are in other rooms, okay, that aren't hooked up to cable or whatever. But, that's what we're looking at, and I'm not sure. So, I mean, the poor are going to get hurt by not having television. But, television, within talking about maybe half a century or 60 years, let's call it, since 1949, television went from this extreme luxury, sort of like going to the movies. I mean, I don't know if we really consider that a luxury, but it's not a necessity. We don't have to go to the movies, although we do a lot. And television now is considered a necessity. Most people would think to not have television would be to be terribly deprived. I don't know. I mean, we're watching the Magic and the Lakers game or the Pittsburgh and Detroit, it's pretty good to see that. It's good on, you know, high-def television, on a big screen and all that. But, our forebears lived without it, I guess. And the fact that, like most things that start off or have a possibility of use if you keep it under control, of course, being good Americans, we don't keep it under control. Like cigarette smoking. There are these people, this will be too much of a diversion, but they believe that it's okay to smoke 2 cigarettes a day, right? You have one after lunch and one after dinner. Boom, that's it. And they're really disciplined, and that's all they do. So, and probably you'd be okay. You wouldn't, you wouldn't probably... I don't know. Maybe some of you doctors out there can tell me. But I think you wouldn't have a great chance of lung cancer. But we smoke 2 packs a day when we get addicted to it. Of course, the tobacco companies help out by making it addictive. But that's another question. So, same thing with television. Having some programs on that we'd watch every once in a while, big sporting events. Because people say that, I can't remember the phrase I used to use, that it's not a waste of time. But that's what it seems to be good for. I mean, the news program, at first I started thinking, oh, good, I can watch all these news programs. I go, oh, man, those don't do much for me. But watching sports, watching movies on there, that's what I go for. All right, Peter Werby's My Name, Jalene Jordan is off for the night. Our numbers are 313-298-WRIF. And speaking about sports, let's get Sherry on the air. She's calling from Warren, and she's got a report on Tiger Stadium. Is that right, Sherry?
Yeah, that's right, Peter. I'd like to talk about what is going on right now, and I'd like to dispel some of the untruthiness, as Steve Colbert says, regarding what is going down at the corner right now.
Wait a minute. Let's set this up a little. Now, we're talking about the old ballpark, Trumbull and Michigan Avenue. Many people think it was completely demolished, or some people don't realize that it was demolished at all. I just went down there the other day with some people, and all you have is what, the third base grandstands?
Well, that, Peter, is what we call the old Tiger Stadium Conservancy. Calls the Navin Field configuration, what the plans are, and with the funding that is now in place, the total, there's a lot of myths and regarding, people think that that's how we want to leave Tiger Stadium. That is not what's going on, and that's not what the money that has been raised so far, which is like, over $400,000, right now, and plus Senator Carl Levin has earmarks for an additional $3.4 million to restore the Navin Field configuration of Tiger Stadium, have it as a as an educational venue, and also it's about putting jobs in Detroit. It's a fabulous city asset for hosting special events of all kinds.
Mm-hmm.
There's a myth that the city of Detroit is being charged for the maintenance and security. That's not true. The old Tiger Stadium Conservancy has been paying for the costs since October of 2008.
Well, Sherry, who wants to tear it down?
The DEGC, which is Detroit Economic Growth Corporation.
Yeah. Why do they want to tear it down?
They want to tear it down because they don't have a plan. They say that there's other developers interested in the property. The OTSC, which is the old Tiger Stadium Conservancy, which I've been a supporter of for as long as it's been around, has not been informed of any competitive development proposals. And, they say the cost is $33.4 million. The total project cost is $27 million. And to date, we've secured $3.8 million in federal appropriations, allowing us, to leverage an additional $14 million in historic tax credits.
So this would keep alive a portion of Tiger Stadium. And when I think about that, how my grandfather took my father there to see the Tiger Greats, and how my father took me there and I saw the Tiger Greats, and to preserve part of it. I mean, I never did buy the argument of the need for a new stadium and was supportive of the group that was trying to preserve it. the group that the group was never naysayers, as you're saying now, Sherry. The group that wanted to preserve the old Tiger Stadium had had forward-looking plans to meet a lot of the modern needs, and a ballpark that is so steeped in baseball history that baseball had been played for almost a century. So they got the new stadium, and then people, what are they going to do with the old one? So now about two-thirds of it is shut down. And Navin Field was what? Was that the original, or that was the second one? It was what? It was originally Bennett Field, wasn't it?
Oh, Navin Field, then Bennett Field, I believe.
Okay, so Navin Field began like in the 19th century, and the last game was played in Tiger Stadium in 1999 that I had the privilege of being at.
Mm-hmm. I'm just recently getting back to Detroit, so after like 30 years, so excuse my ignorance of some of the facts. You know, I all through my travels, I ended up back in Detroit, and I'll tell you what, I'm living, this is my life. This is my, I mean, besides, you know, like, you know, my music and everything, this is my life, is trying to save Tiger Stadium for, you know, for the people of Detroit. I really believe strongly that this project represents it's a unique opportunity to make Detroit a destination.
And wait a minute, though, but we have a situation now where there was an attempt on Friday to begin demolishing what was left of it.
Oh, yeah, I was down there, and I'll tell you what.
Tell us about that, though.
I never thought I would ever, ever congratulate people from Fox News, because I think Bill O'Reilly's a fascist, and I think that Sean Hannity is...
All right, stay on way with Sherry. Stay on point. Stay on point here.
Okay, but there's a couple people from Fox News, you know, namely Brad Evans and Andrea Isom. I think that's how her name is pronounced. And I'll tell you what, they've had more guts in speaking up for preservation and... funding of, you know, of conserving the stadium for future use, to make it an attraction, to make it, it's an opportunity to make Detroit a destination, than any of the other talking heads that I've seen on Channel 4 or Channel 7.
Well, listen, you know, one of the things, Sherry, that I'm always reminded by my union brothers and sisters that work at Fox News, that they have no relationship to the national Fox Noise or the Foxhole News, however you want to call it. But look, I've got to move on. So give me the dramatic details of what happened Friday and what's going to happen tomorrow morning in court.
Okay. So tomorrow, Judge Edwards is going to be hearing the stop order that was issued very dramatically by a man named Chip Owen running out on the field. He had to squeeze through the fence, Peter.
To stop the demolition.
Yeah, to halt the demolition. He served the guy on a caterpillar. He squeezed through that fence. And I was there with my brother on our bikes, and we asked several people from P. Riley, several people from the, you know, the old Tiger Stadium Conservancy. He said, please try to call some police, because we're trying to get him in there.
Right, because what was happening is that they were illegally beginning this process of demolition, that the Conservancy group got a stay and had to push through, as you said, had to push through this fence in order to serve it. It stopped, and now they're all supposed to be in court on Monday morning.
Yes, right. And I want to encourage people to show up at a rally at Jefferson and Woodward in front of the Spirit of Detroit, going from 8:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Monday, tomorrow.
Okay.
And to call David Bing, his numbers. Can I give his number?
The people can look it up. Listen, I have to move along, but is there a website that the Conservancy has, something where people could check this out?
We've got a plan.
What's that?
We've got a plan. We've got the cash. We've got a plan.
Okay. Know? Do you have a website?
Yes. It's www.savetigerstadium.org.
All right. And what's left of it. So I think that's important. Well, Sherry, thanks for sharing the information with me. And, yeah, so 8:30 tomorrow morning, Woodward and Jefferson, that's a city-county building, the old city-county building, I guess, and where this case will be heard. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
All right, I appreciate it. And is that a diversion, Steve? I think this is really important. Keep memory alive. Everything didn't begin 3 years ago. And this edifice, so steeped in history. And when I went by there the other day, and saw that three quarters of old Tiger Stadium broke my heart. In fact, there was no reason in the first place to even move. And Roger reminds me that it was also Briggs Stadium. It was owned by the guy who owned Briggs Manufacturing. And the UAW, when they were having a strike at the Briggs plant, they would take their pickets down to Briggs Stadium, like in the 40s, and picket down there to tell the attendees of a Tigers and Red Sox or a Tigers and Yankee game before they got all those teams in there from who knows where, that I still swear are minor league teams. Anyways, don't start me. I can't even tell half the time. You know, I hear some of this these team names. I think, what is that? Is that basketball? Is that? And then I find out, you know, hockey teams from the only place that that the people have ever seen ice is in like a mixed drink. Don't start me. All right, you're starting yourself, Pete. Right, I know. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here's Daryl in Romulus. Hi, Daryl. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
The reason I'm calling in is about the seatbelt law.
Yeah.
Is I'm unable to wear a seatbelt to a physical condition.
Okay.
The police officer in Livonia told me to my face that my doctor has no authority of giving me a doctor's note. I went to court. The judge said the same thing. I called my legislator. Underneath section 257-710E, okay, says right here, any operator or passenger unable to wear a seatbelt with a doctor's verification for a physical condition is exempt from wearing a seatbelt.
Well, good. I mean, you would think there'd be that exemption in the law.
Okay, I called Lansing to the Secretary of State. And they have out there, I told them, why can't you do it for people like me? They have out there a restriction for people with tinted windows.
Uh-huh.
I threw up the argument, why can't you do it for people that cannot wear a seatbelt and put it on their driver's license? For 15 years, I've been fighting to get this thing done. All right, I call Channel 7, they won't tell it. Call 4, they won't tell it. So the next best thing I thought would be talking on your show because anybody can talk about anything they want.
That's right. But what about what Jerry was saying? What about Fox News?
I didn't even call them because what was the use? If Channel 4 wouldn't touch it, Channel 7 wouldn't do it, I would think Channel 2 wouldn't think it was important enough either.
I would try Fox. I think in many ways, I don't know, I'm probably going to get myself in trouble. Never mind. I would try Fox News. You know, the worst that can happen is you can get another rebuff, right?
Exactly. Another someone saying, oh, it's very interesting. We'll get back with you. Nobody's ever called me back or anything.
But wait a minute. What about, were you ever fined or ticketed?
Yes.
And were those thrown out?
No, I have been ticketed in the past. During the past 15 years, yes, it was thrown out. This last time I went to court in Livonia, the judge looked at me and said the same thing. Your doctor has no authority.
Huh.
So
they don't know the law.
I appealed. I put an appeal. It cost me $75 to put the appeal in. I don't go to court again until June 17th. June 17th, I'm having this paper in my hot little hand along with my doctor's note. I'm pleading not guilty to it. With reasonable explanation, when the police officer raises his hand and says, well, he handed me a doctor's note, and blah, 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 then I'm going to sit there and say, well, underneath this section here, because, see, this law was made in 1949.
Wow.
Any vehicle, here's the thing, any vehicle manufactured before January 1st, 1965, is exempt from wearing a seatbelt. They mention in there bus, motorcycle, and moped.
Well, Daryl, you, I think, are disproving the saying, you cannot fight City Hall, because it sounds like you're doing a hell of a job. All right, after you go to court, call us back, okay?
I'll call you back after I go to court. I know I can't call you back on Sunday, but the following Sunday I can call you back and let you know how I made out.
All right, thanks a lot, Daryl.
Yep.
Bye-bye, and good luck on it. Yeah, come on. I mean, you would think they would know the law. Speaking about the economy, if you're just joining me, I got a bit of a cold. You can get a lot of it like that. My apologies in advance. Hint of hope as jobless rate jumps to almost 10%. You go, wait a minute, where's the hope here? According to the New York Times today, what is today? Yesterday, I guess it is. The American economy shed 345,000 jobs in May. It means almost 350,000 of us lost our jobs. That's good news. Why? And the unemployment rate spiked to 9.4%. That's good news. But why? Because the losses were far smaller than anticipated, amplifying hopes of a recovery. Economists describe the Labor Department's monthly jobs report as an unambiguous sign of improvement, yet also clear evidence of broadening national distress as millions of households grapple with joblessness and lost working hours. The fact that a report showing the highest unemployment rate in more than a quarter century was embraced optimistically testified to the stark fears over the economy in recent months. I mean, there still is this deep fear that it's very possible that things could get much, much worse. Now, I mean, people call George Bush, and I think reasonably so, Herbert Hoover, the guy that presided over the first 4 years of the Depression. But that's the key word, the first 4 years. I mean, if Barack Obama turns out to be Hoover, in other words, things keep spiraling downward, because now it's not just subprime loan borrowers that are losing their homes. Now it's regular middle-class people, because they've been blown out of their jobs. And also, the whole era of high-paying jobs for many of us, that may be gone away as well. But the article says, if the primal fear is ended, that is, that things are going to really go down the drain, comfort is nowhere to be found. Home prices appear to have hit bottom in some areas of the country, but construction remains weak. The auto industry and retailing remain in distress. The job market is likely to remain in the doldrums for many months. And what's always missing in that kind of language is that the human factor. You or someone you know, a family member that's lost their job, and suddenly everything that they had planned, maybe even their home and plans for their children, like college, are just down the drain. A home foreclosure crisis is growing, thus far unchecked by an Obama administration program aimed at stemming the problem. As more foreclosed properties land on markets, real estate prices are falling further, adding to the losses and uncertainties confronting banks. Now, I'm not really sure why there's not a sector of the population that can't start grabbing some homes, and I think that's happening. Home sales were up like 6% last month or something like that. I mean, in some of these suburbs around Detroit, there's homes for like $25,000. Let's see, for more than a decade, economic growth and attendant American job opportunities were fueled by swelling wealth and liberal access to credit. As home prices soared, homeowners availed themselves of myriad forms of credit that turned increased real estate values into cash. People kept refinancing and taking some of that cash and doing other stuff with it. They sprinkled those funds on an array of industries, generating jobs from auto factories and lumber mills to construction companies in restraint. Now, as paychecks disappear and home prices fall, people are increasingly inclined to save, a rough transition in a country which consumer spending makes up 70% of economic activity. So, thrift used to be encouraged. Now, if we're not out there spending, we're not good Americans. On the other hand, people are worried about that. People are worried about the ability, certainly, to spend on credit, what the results of that is going to be. The jobs report presented a statistical puzzle. After shedding an average of more than 700,000 jobs each month during the first quarter, the economy lost 504,000 jobs in April, and so it's decreasing. Yet the unemployment rate leapt from an already high 8.9%, reinforcing fears it would reach double digit. So we are starting to get into depression-level unemployment. Manufacturers cut 156,000 jobs in May. Worse on the way when you start looking at what's happening with General Motors and all that. Construction jobs, almost 60,000. Professional business services shed 51,000. Restaurants and bars added nearly 9,000 jobs. Because I don't know, what does that mean? People going out and... that's why I'm fighting the microphone. Going out and drowning their sorrows. Yeah, I go in restaurants and I'm thinking, man, You wouldn't know there's a recession or maybe even a depression going on. A lot of these restaurants and places like Royal Oak and all that, downtown Detroit, they're just filled with people, right? Medical bills prompt more than 60% of U.S. bankruptcies. And there's another argument for having both the effect it would have on individuals and also on businesses. Could you imagine any business owners out there? Could you imagine that if you did not have to provide medical insurance for your employees, that it was like most or almost all industrialized countries in the world, that this was a function of government, that it would be paid by through the general tax fund? So wait a minute, I don't want to raise my taxes. Well, you're already probably paying a ton anyway. I mean, I have a health program through work here, but I got to pay, you know, I don't know how much a year, a couple grand minimum. So, you know, speaking of finances, we got to, you know, the way a commercial radio pays me and all of that is through advertisement. So listen to these and stay with me and call 313-298-WRIF, and I'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Unravel iPhone 3G at the IT store. Download the free WRIF app. Connect with just one touch and listen to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Is it wrong that I was totally aroused by that?
Details at WRIF.com from 101.
Just announced. Now for the month of June, your Metro Detroit Ford dealers and Genuine Ford Parts and Service have great service offers for you. Get the Works Fuel Saver Package for only $29.95 after $10 mail-in rebate. It's a Motorcraft synthetic blend oil change, tire rotation, multi-point inspection, fluid top-off, and more, all for just $29.95. At Ford dealerships, there are Ford-trained technicians using Genuine Ford Parts and guaranteed low prices. So hurry to a participating Metro Detroit Ford dealer today for money-saving rebates on brakes, batteries, tires, and much more. Visit www.thinkfordfirst.com for a dealership near you. Taxes, diesel, and disposal fee extra. See participating dealerships for hours and rebate details through 11:30:09.
Want a chance to win $25,000 towards a new Ford vehicle or a $100 gas card? It's easy, it's fun, and you can play the cash scramble now at winwithford.com. That's winwithford.com from your Metro Detroit Ford dealers.
Yeah, let's see. On my agenda today, I got lunch with Dave.
Drops.
Then my afternoon business meeting.
Drops.
Then happy hour.
Drops.
Listen to that little voice inside your head. Trumps is the place for lunch, happy hour, and entertainment that will be appreciated during any business meeting. Every day, Trumps has their delicious burger and beer lunch for only $9.99. And every day, Trumps has lunch specials for under $10, including ribeye steaks. That's right, lunch for under $10 and Trumps Entertainment. And Tuesday is always all-you-can-eat crab legs day. Trumps has Detroit's best happy hour. All beers at Trumps are just $4.25 and shots for just $3. So schedule your next happy hour meeting at Trump's and see why Trump's was voted Metro Detroit's best VIP room by Maxim magazine.
Trump's on 8 Mile, just a half mile east of Telegraph, home of the world's most beautiful women. Preview the fun at Trump's8mile.com. Trump's.
High on the hog and for a great cause. It's the fourth annual Rally in Hell. June 14th at Hell Creek Ranch in Hell, Michigan. Get on board one of the rides departing from many local Harley-Davidson dealerships. Check out great live music from Send More Cops, 60 Second Crush, and more. 100% of net proceeds to benefit Ozone House, helping runaway and homeless youth. Get more details at www.therallyinhell.com.
Next! Little Caesar's new deep dish pizza.
Nuts. Little Caesar's new deep dish pizza.
Nuts.
We're searching for the right voice to introduce Little Caesar's new hot and ready deep dish pizza. A large deep dish pepperoni pizza for only $7.
Little Caesar's new deep dish pizza.
Nuts.
Introducing Little Caesar's new deep dish pizza.
Next? You know what happened to the last guy who told me next? He's deep. 6 feet deep.
Security.
Little Caesar's new hot and ready deep dish pizza. A large deep dish pepperoni pizza hot out of the oven. on, ready when you are. All day, every day. Plus, our unique cut delivers a crunchy crust in every slice. Only $7 at Little Caesars.
New deep dish pizza is what?
Next!
Pizza, pizza.
Again?
Pizza, pizza.
Can you make it deeper?
Pizza, pizza.
Perfect!
Little Caesar's new deep dish pizza. A large $7 pepperoni pizza. 8 huge crunchy slices. All day, every day. Tonight, go deep with Little Caesar.
Pizza, pizza.
Held on. Objected to it. Many workplaces still aren't smoke-free.
That's true. It seems there's more proof there are links to heart disease and cancers from exposure to secondhand smoke.
Absolutely. Secondhand smoke puts you at risk for heart attack or lung cancer. Nearly 3,000 people a year are dying from secondhand smoke. People shouldn't have to choose between a paycheck and their health. Michigan should be smoke-free. Visit michigan.gov/tobacco to see how you can help.
Thank you, Greg. This important message was brought to you by the Michigan Department of Community Health.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Jalene Jordan is off tonight. 313-298-WRIF. We were talking earlier with Sherry from Warren, who was telling us what's happening at the old ballpark down at Trumbull in Michigan, where the Tigers played for so many years. And Dave Mitchell writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, Peter, I am the treasurer of the Tiger Stadium Conservancy. What was remaining until the illegal demolition on Friday was a bona fide historic Major League ballpark, Navin Field. That was what it was originally, not merely a portion of Tiger Stadium. The Conservancy, was in the process of obtaining designation from the National Trust in order to be eligible for historic tax credits. Already received designation from the state. Thanks for the discussion. Hope to see you in the morning. What he's talking about, there's a demonstration 8:30 in the morning at Jefferson and Woodward in the site of the old City County building, where there's going to be a hearing to enjoin these people that are trying to knock it down illegally. I don't understand this. This could be a real source of jobs and a historical site. I mean, think of the people that have played there. I mean, the Tigers. When you start naming the people that played in Navin Field, Bennett Field, Briggs Stadium, Tigers Stadium, on that corner, you're talking about the history of baseball, right? All right, we're also talking about the economy. Steve wrote in and said, why are you talking about gay marriage when we should be talking about the economy? That's what's sending us all to hell. Well, one of the things that's sending us all to hell is medical costs, and that includes businesses. When you think about all these negotiations with the car companies and the UAW and who has responsibility for the health benefits for retirees, and what a huge portion of that is. Well, medical bills prompt more than 60% of U.S. bankruptcies, and that's not from companies. That's from individuals. Every year, it's estimated that 1.5 million Americans will declare bankruptcy, and 60% of it they're capsized by medical bills, it says, according to the CNNHealth.com article. Bankruptcies due to medical bills increased by nearly 50% in a six-year period, from 46% in 2001 to 62% in 2007. Is probably getting worse. And again, we are the only industrialized country in the world that does not have a decent, full-fledged, paid national health plan. If you never saw Sicko, the Michael Moore film, you ought to get it as a DVD and check it out. This would lift such an incredible burden from so many people somewhere in this mess here. How did I make such a mess of all of this already? But with people losing their job, and so many of us are aging or ill family members, and as we lose jobs, as we get cut in our hours, as we get pay cuts, the capacity of the individuals in a family to care for their relatives is diminishing as well. Why should we be subjected to this in the wealthiest country in the world? There was, let's see if I can find this, but there was a story in here that's called, this is another one, but I don't know, where do these things disappear to? But this, it was about how the 0.000046% of us live, and that is the ultra wealthy. And I remember I was toting up, oh yeah, here it is. Oh no, I'm way, way giving it the percentage too low. It's how the other, you used to say how the other half lives. Well, this is an article in, where is it, dissentvoice.org, dissentvoice.org, how the other 0.0000003% lives. And we're talking about my the people I'd love to beat up on the best as the ultra-wealthy, the Walton families that are the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th wealthiest people in the country. They all make about $23 billion, but they have, well, like the richest is Jim Walton, who's got $23.4 billion, and then Sam Walton, Jr., I guess, $23.3, so it's like that. And the combined total of these four in the family, one of them got killed, you may remember. They make 92. Their wealth, their individual wealth, is $92 billion. And remember, these they're the owners of a firm that they do everything they can to keep worker wages low. I mean, one of them could take half their salary and make every employee of Walmart be the best paid workers with the best benefits in the country. And you would think that they would spend their time trying to do something like get a national health plan in. Rather, instead, like in 2004, Alice Walton, who's worth she's one of the poorer ones, $23.2 billion. She donated $2.6 million to the right-wing group called Progress for America, which runs ads supporting the Iraq War and thanking George W. Bush for supposedly preventing another 9/11 attack on American soil. And most of them, not all of them, like William Buffett, or Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates, they do, you know, a lot of good charitable work. But most of these, like the 10th and 9th, are the Koch brothers, and they're far right wingers. They do all of this. Let me see. The brothers provided monies for American for Prosperity. That they helped organize the right wing tea parties, and they toured non-plumber Joe the Plumber, Samuel Wurzbacher, through Pennsylvania to present a working class speaker against the Employee Free Choice Act legislation that would make it easier for working people to organize unions. Now, here you have these two guys that between them are worth $38 billion. That's their net worth. Nothing that they could ever do could they even spend any of that. And you would think, what would they possibly care if every worker in the country was unionized? Well, that would certainly up the cost of labor. And if every employee was unionized and could get a decent living wage with great benefits. But what would happen to them? I mean, actually, one of them could pay for the entire uptick of what this would all cost if every employee was unionized and got better wages and better benefits, as union workers do. So it would cost maybe $19 billion. So David Koch could just write a check, I hear. And, well, he's poorer than he's zero. Well, maybe his brother could split what's left, give him $10 billion, right? These people. All right. Eat the rich, because, man, they're eating us, aren't they? 313-298-WRIF. Let's take some calls here. Here's Rod. Rod's in Port Huron. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I'm calling regarding the GM and Chrysler, you know.
Sure.
And bankruptcy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to the medical benefits and the pensions and for retirees and also suppliers? What's going to happen to suppliers and stuff like that, you think?
No, I don't know about suppliers. They're, you know, the farther you are away from the bigger money, what's all going to be flowing to GM, probably the worst off you are if you're working for them. Supposedly,
yeah.
All the retiree pension plans and the health benefits are going to remain intact, but you have already, I mean, the UAW already, you know, sounded a retreat a couple of years ago when they agreed to a two-tier wage system. So now, what do you have? You have UAW workers making less than the median, not the median, what the hell is it? The median wage.
Right, because I've heard that GM is going to send a lot of their stuff to China to manufacture, Brazil.
Right.
And a company named Opel in Europe is going to purchase, I think, part of GM, but Opel, is recently purchased by Russia.
There is a Russian bank and a Canadian parts manufacturer that have put together a consortium to buy all these. Opel probably has a pretty strong union. The German auto workers union is very powerful, and I actually don't know for sure what's going to how they're going to react. I mean, they're probably going to react a little different than here, where the unions just sort of roll over.
Yeah, Germany's got a better record with that kind of stuff. At least that's what I've heard.
Sure.
I'll say a few quick things, and then you can get on with somebody else, I guess.
Go ahead.
People vote for Republican or Democrat and stuff like that, and they say, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican. Overall, what I see is that neither of the parties are doing what we want anyway. So I say don't vote for either.
Well, there's something there. You know, that actually happened.
Don't ever.
Let me see. I need Jolene here. So she, what happened, there was these elections in the European Union, speaking of, here it is. It says, conservatives race towards victory in some of Europe's largest economies Sunday as exit polls showed voters punishing left-leaning parties in European Parliament elections in France, Germany, and a number of other countries. So what happens is everybody realizes what skunks these right-wing conservatives are, and they go, oh, we got to get rid of these guys. We got to put in some, liberals or socialists.
Yeah, yeah.
And then so nothing changes too much, and then they go, oh, we got to put in these conservatives because these liberals and these leftists didn't do good for us. And so it's a merry-go-round. I mean, having Barack Obama in there on so many levels is such a vast improvement. But he, so far, has not been capable of moving outside of the dominant model of what has got us into this problem in the first place. And I don't think he has political space to do that because he's in the system, he's part of the system, and the only way, pardon me, when things begin to change is when masses of people begin operating, I don't mean outside the system, anything illegally, but start, huge mass movements demanding change. And I think Barack Obama would be susceptible to that. But so far, we are just having the audacity of hope, to quote the title of his book. We're just hoping that we don't get screwed any more than we are. We're hoping that this new crop of people in can't possibly be as bad as the last bandits and war criminals, which I don't think they can be. But I don't know that they necessarily have the capacity to solve things. So say, okay, it's thrown to us. So what do we do? Well, that's the sticker. I haven't a clue what to do.
Yeah, well, I suggest, if people want to, we've heard about Gerald Celente, right?
Who's that?
This guy named Gerald Celente. You can watch his videos or listen to his videos on YouTube.
Okay.
And then people have different opinions about this guy, but he's a talk show host, Alex Jones on InfoWars.
Yeah, I don't know. Those guys don't do much for me.
He actually predicted GM going bankruptcy 2.5 years ago. I mean, people don't agree with everybody, but also the banks have, they've gotten all this money, they're getting all these bailouts, and it's like the big guys have got everything, the little guys have gotten nothing practically.
Yeah, well,
they're stealing from us.
What do you mean practically nothing? We've gotten anything. We've gotten nothing. Well, that's what I'm saying. It's still the idea that the enormous financial institutions and production institutions are the absolute key to a healthy economy. Now, you would think on the face of it, you would say, yeah, you want big financial institutions, you want big industrial facilities and what have you. But the more complex any system is, the larger it is, the larger capacity for collapse it has.
Actually, what I was saying is that we need to have manufacturing here. And we can't just say we're going to create money and we're going to create sales jobs, because if you don't really make your own stuff, you're what is it called, sales or a servant?
Service,
society, and that's slavery.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've heard that said. If you don't, you know, if you're not a productive, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not arguing with you about it. I mean, it part of it is that we the people that are the most affected by this, the people that want to real change the most, haven't really locked on to a solution, haven't a movement or programs and agendas haven't been developed yet, but they will. I mean,
yeah, you know what I recommend? The people, they get pissed off enough, they force the government to do what we want.
Well, yeah, that's what it all is.
You know, this wouldn't have happened in the 50s.
No.
Imagine that back then.
No, absolutely. All right, well, thank you very much.
Put your throats out.
Thank you, Rod.
Thank you much.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye now. Now, how about Hummer? I can't even believe this. Hummer now is being sold off to a Chinese company. General Motors has taken a key step towards downsizing Tuesday, striking a tentative deal to sell its Hummer brand to a Chinese manufacturer. And it looks like there's potential buyer for Saturn. It doesn't say it in this article, but I think the Penske organization may pick up Saturn. Saab, which is a Swedish company anyways, why don't the Swedes buy it? How about that? China's Sichuan Tianzhong Heavy Industrial Machinery Company said Tuesday afternoon that it reached an agreement to acquire the brand from GM for an undisclosed amount. GM said the sale will save more than 3,000 U.S. jobs in manufacturing, engineering, and at various Hummer dealerships. Cheng Zong said it will assume GM's existing agreements with Hummer dealers. Would you bet on any of this? How long before this is all just going to go away and all be done in China? Well, why should they pay, they're going to argue, why should they pay people wages and benefits that have been struggled for and fought for with the loss of lives, and if you go back to the 30s, and that constitutes a living wage when you can pay people 40 cents an hour, or even in Mexico, you can have people assembling cars for a couple dollars an hour. That's the free market, folks. That's what unions fight against, the free market. They want us to be paid a decent wage for the work that we're doing. But a little more on Hummer when we come back. Any Hummer owners out there? Well, I'd like to hear what you think about all of this. Because think about this. The Hummer is the symbol of American macho Let me try it one more time. The Hummer is a symbol of American macho prowess, and it's being sold off to a Chinese company. What do you think? 313-298-WRIF. Right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
The future is here. We do not need to be afraid anymore.
From your iPhone 3G, download the free WRIF app in the iTunes Store. It gives you one-touch access to WRIF streaming live wherever you are. Get more details at WRIF.com.
The Riff.
How long have I been telling you about Jack Demarlink and Mercury? I've driven a lot of their cars, and when I'm there, I always feel confident that the dealership is forthright, they're reliable, and they're there to support their customers' needs. Jack Demarlink and Mercury wants to invite you to check out the all-new Mercury Milan. It's a sophisticated sedan with abundant standard and available features like stylish satin aluminum accents, advanced technology features which include a voice-activated DVD-based navigation system, and the hands-free control of the sync system. And thanks to a 5-star frontal crash test rating, the all-new 2009 Mercury Milan shows its protective side as well. Right now, through March 31st, renewal customers can lease an all-new 2009 Mercury Milan for 39 months for only $199 per month with $2,150 down, including security deposit plus tax, title, plates, and approved credit. See dealer for details. Discover the Demmer difference today. Jack Demmer, Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue, just east of Oakwood Boulevard, or visit Demmer.com.
Prices assume 5% down payment at 7.5% APR over 30 years.
Wow, look at this place. 4 bedrooms, 2 baths.
Yeah, I know.
Jeez, you're not even 30. We have the same salary, Maggie. How can you afford all this?
My mortgage payment is less than $300 a month.
What? That's less than I pay for rent. How? How did you...
All I did was call BNI for a list of homes that are being sold for back taxes or foreclosure.
Home foreclosures are on the rise. That means there are great deals out there, especially for first-time home buyers. Like this listing, a four-bedroom, two-bath going for under $20,000. That's just $199 a month. Listings go fast, so call BNI for a list of these homes today. Call 1-800-497-5930.
I could actually afford to own my own home.
Yeah, and it's easy. Just call BNI for the list.
Properties that have been foreclosed or repossessed are a real bargain and sometimes sell for little money down. For a list of homes in your area, call 1-800-497-5930. 1-800-497-5930. That's 1-800-497-5930.
It's Heaven and Hell all this weekend on the Riff. Keep it locked to win tickets for the return of Heaven and Hell. Ronnie James Dio, Tony Iommi, Geezer Butler, Vinny Appice. With special guests Coheed and Cambria, August 21st at Meadowbrook Music Festival. One lucky Riffler will also score a signed, framed Heaven and Hell lithograph. The Riff's Heaven and Hell weekend.
Listen and win.
From 101 WRIF.
WRIF
WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour of WRIF's Night Call. Peter Werby here with you, with cold and without Jalene Jordan, who is off for the evening. Let's see, tonight at 1 a.m., I'll be featuring an interview with Sasha Abramski. He's written a book called Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It. Imagine that. We, in the wealthiest country in the world, there are millions of people face hunger. Not people starving to death. We're not talking about Ethiopia or anything like that. But there's a lot of hunger in the world. Also, Danny Schechter, an old pal of mine, who's editor of MediaChannel.org, talks about his recent article, American Expression, Card Companies Resisting Reforms and How the New Legislation Will Affect Credit Card Debtors. You know, there's this, they just put it past this bill that would allegedly help us out. See, we've got some email. Billy says, actually, let me get this other one first, and I'll get his on. Patrick wrote into Call Talk, yes, at yahoo.com, responding to the Tiger Conservancy Group, which wants to retain what's left of Tiger Stadium, which is now the old part of the old Navin Field, as it was 100 years ago. He says, Peter, I think the old stadium should be torn down, put it in its place, a new city park, since it was a park to begin with. Now, I don't understand this, Patrick. Don't send another email. Maybe you should call 313-298-WRIF. What does this last line mean? The last thing the city needs is more development? That's the first thing we need. Am I missing something here? And that's one of the things that the Conservancy Group for Tiger Stadium is talking about, is they can provide more jobs. Not a jillion of them, that's for sure. Let's see. Billy writes to Call Talk, yes, at yahoo.com. I just discovered that Michigan law allows you to carry a pistol without a permit as long as you have it holstered in plain view and registered. Do you have any information on this? What's your outlook on this? Yeah, I just think we ought to all carry guns, right? And then every once in a while, have a shootout. And we, you know. I don't know if that is law. Some of you... gunners out there maybe can tell us. I tend to doubt that, but can you? Is there open carry? I mean, well, that kind of goes with. Let's go back to the Hummer in terms of symbols of American macho prowess. GM selling Hummer off to a Chinese company. Any of you Hummer owners out there, I wonder what your fix on this is, because when people began buying them, did people still buy them? Because that was like a symbol of the sort of Top Gun Bush Rumsfeld militarism that looked like it was just going to be so terrific when we would just do this walk through Iraq. And then, of course, when it turned out to be another one of these quagmires, with there's no exit plan, and there still really isn't, and things are still going to hell, and thousands of American soldiers have been killed, and they still get killed every single week, and not probably not one in a thousand of us, unless we know somebody that's there, even thinks about Iraq or has any idea of the kind of catastrophic casualties that American troops are suffering. Catastrophic, I don't mean that there's 500 a week the way there was in Vietnam or something like that. But the severity of the wounds and the tens of thousands of men and women that are coming home with without faces and without arms and with the kind of emotional impact that we've found that this type of war occupation really has, the toll it takes on soldiers, and the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that have been hurt so badly that worse than they ever would have been if Saddam Hussein would have remained there. The United States little puppet up until he crossed a line or two that U.S. didn't like. But in any event, the Hummer now seems to be sort of a dinosaur, literally in size, in gas mileage, because it's going up, folks, almost $3. In fact, I saw it 303 up north earlier this week where I was. And also of a military policy that that hardly anyone supports any longer. Your thoughts on it, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here is Brian. Brian's in Pontiac. Hey, Brian, you got a Hummer?
No, I don't have a Hummer, but I've been in the car business for a while, and it has been my dream car for the longest time.
Why?
I was selling Dodges over at Kamaroff. You know where that's going. But,
sure.
My father-in-law is actually an engineer on one of the H2 programs. And I've discussed with him for a while on this thing, and I've actually given him driving a few of them. The only one that really is kind of an icon of masculinity, I think, is the H1, the ones that are no longer produced for retail. The
right.
ones that are pretty essentially just military ones that they dress up a little bit.
Yeah, they don't do those anymore. Okay.
Yeah, the H2s and the H3s, which the GM still does, are really kind of yuppie mobiles.
Really?
I mean, they're like Cadillacs on big, giant tires.
Wow.
And you know, as it is, the H3 was pretty much designed for women. So I think what they'll do is the Chinese will buy it and they'll ship them back over here for the uppies that want to buy them, and they'll have lead in the paint, and they'll have some other bad stuff. I mean, I'm sure we'll just get the garbage that we've been getting them from a while, apparently.
Well, all right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Appreciate your call. All right, well, all right. So the military Hummer, no more. That's not the. I mean. It sure looks like a pretty ugly car to me. I mean, isn't it? Aren't the cars about sleek lines? Isn't it? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Here's Dustin in Fenton. Dustin, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm just calling about General Motors selling Hummer. I understand they need to sell some of their bad assets, but I don't agree with them selling to China because they're stealing a lot of jobs as it is, and they're saying they're going to save 3,000 jobs, but like you said, the question is for how long?
Right.
And my uncle, he works up in a manufacturing up in North, and the Chinese actually bought them out, and they told them, yeah, we're going to keep the factory here, and we're not going to get rid of your jobs. Well, sure enough, a month later, they came, and they're like, all right, we're taking all the machinery and taking it back to the homeland, and you guys have a job. Sorry, good luck. And
yeah.
Personally, I think it's a wrong decision. They shouldn't do it, and that's pretty much it. So.
Well, okay. Thank you, Dustin.
Yep, you have a good one.
Appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Let's go to Mike. Mike is in Monroe, the home of Fermi 2 and George Custer as well. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Thanks, Barry. I've been a listener for quite some time now.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Basically, my issue right now is the Nevea Buchanan case here in Monroe.
What in the world is that?
It was the little girl that disappeared.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, and it made national news.
That's right.
And everything.
Yeah.
The sad part of it is all the other cases of abused children in just this county alone that have been overlooked for literally decades. It's pretty sad that the only time this county does something to protect a child is when the body bag is needed.
Wow, yeah.
I personally can vouch for at least half a dozen cases where my own daughter was stabbed by her mother with a pencil.
Really?
And she got parenting classes.
Huh.
And I know another case where a father molested his own daughter. The only penalty he had was write off his rights to her, and he packed up and left town.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's happened. And it's kind of sickening that, you know, it takes a case where a child, you know, a five-year-old at that, is victimized, and the media just plays it for all it's worth. I mean, what, if they were to look into all the child protective cases here in Monroe County, they'd probably have about a year's worth of news on their hands.
Well, you know, there's so many children at risk, and it often takes some tragedy before people even begin to move around the issues. And I don't know. I mean, I think there's a tendency to I was going to say err on the side of caution. That is to say, if you started clapping everybody in jail that it looked like they were endangering children, you'd have a lot of people in jail. On the other hand, erring on the side of caution and protecting our children. I don't know. I don't know how to sort it out. I mean, you're right. I think a lot of ways with these issues that aren't very dramatic and are more every day, unfortunately every day, that the bureaucracy of government probably fails to respond in an immediate way. Well, thanks for bringing that up, Mike. I appreciate that very much. And let's see. Here is, I can't get your name too well, but calling from Taylor. What is it? What's your name? Jadubby?
J.W.
Okay, J.W., you're on the air.
This is J.W. I'm calling about that gay pride thing that's going on. I want to know. Yeah, you know they want to go and be gay. Let them be gay, but they don't give it a home to murder somebody to save them. Or if they want to go dancing up and down the street, let them do it somebody for nice and quiet. Nobody sees them.
You know, I think you need a new phone or something. I can't understand a word you're saying. I'm going to have to cut you loose. J.W., do this. See if you can get like a landline or something like that or get better service because, I don't know, I couldn't get what you were saying. So please call us back if you can get a better line. But today, well, now yesterday, was a Gay Pride Day in Ferndale. So that could have been what he was talking about, eh? Here is Steve in Corktown, which is the area immediately surrounding the old ballpark, historic district. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to straighten out a little bit of what you just said. I don't know if it matters really, but the park originally, back in the 1890s, was called Bennett Park, named after a pitcher from the 1880s. And that was at the corner of Michigan and Trumbull where the home plate was.
Right. Let me just say this. That's what I initially said to this caller from the Conservancy, and she corrected me. So,
oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Okay, you're right. And then in 1912, they built Navin Park. And they moved the corner where home plate is over to what is now Michigan and Cochrane. I don't know what that street. I think it used to be called National Street back then.
Okay.
And that's what you see now. When you said you went to the ballpark the other day.
Right.
Basically, you're seeing third base to first base corner there, you know, where the broadcast booth was and all that.
Okay.
And it's my understanding that they want to even strip down the upper levels and just retain the lowest level, the first level, meaning the Conservancy.
Yeah, I actually
would have stated that.
Right, I don't know what their plans are.
Well, depending on what happens in court, who knows?
Yeah.
Nothing. But, and I didn't know you were interested in this subject. I would have called sooner and asked people to get together years ago because I could tell that Illich, when he was still controlling the place, was, you know, letting it just neglect on purpose.
and fall apart. That
I had a lot of friends in the Tiger Stadium fan club, Frank Rashid and Mike Betzold, and people that spent a couple of years trying to present an alternative to leaving the stadium that would meet some of the needs that the Illich organization said was necessary.
Cochran plan.
Yeah, the Cochran plan, exactly. And I went to a lot of the, I'll only go. I mean, I shouldn't even say this. These are probably some of our advertisers. But, for instance, I'll only go to sports that don't have the expansion teams on it. Like, even the last year, well, I would only go to the games where there was the classic teams, the classic baseball teams. I don't want to go see a team called the Razorbacks or something like that. You know, what is that?
No, that's my ideal.
Yeah.
Well, another thing that you probably know, but maybe your listeners don't know, is there's been a lot of BS in the papers in the last few years stating that the people of Corktown wanted it tore down, meaning Tiger Stadium. And
right.
I have yet to find a neighbor on my street that wants it tore down, but the Detroit News, for some reason, always, screws up the news and says, oh, yeah, it'll be good for the citizens of Corktown to get rid of this ugly thing and all that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so you know how the Detroit News is.
Absolutely. And, apparently some of your neighbors calling from Corktown. So let me say thank you for your comments, Steve. I appreciate it.
All right.
And I'll get on to them. Thank you very much. Here is Gary. Gary's in Detroit's Corktown as well. Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, are you talking to me?
I am talking to you, Gary.
Okay, I am not in Corktown, but that's okay. I'm a officer and director of the Tiger Stadium Conservancy. Just to make a couple corrections to your previous caller, Bennett Park was named after Charlie Bennett, who was a catcher, not a pitcher. And it was Navin Field,
yeah.
Not Navin Park, built in 1912. What we have left there now is a 1912 lower deck foundation. In 1912, Navin Field was built with a single deck, like most ballparks back then. And we have then the upper deck added on top of that in 1923.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a real Major League ballpark. It's just a Major League ballpark circa 1923 or 1930, not 1950 or 1970 or 1999.
Okay. And you were on site, though, when this illegal demolition of what's there now took place?
Well, I was actually preparing for our court hearing on a TRO, a temporary restraining order, with our attorney, and then in court until 5 o'clock when the motion was granted. And then after we got the court order, we got copies of it and raced to the site to make sure they stopped demolition, which we had trouble getting them to stop demolition because nobody answered the door, so to speak, and no one would acknowledge our presence. And so it took a while to get them to stop demolition after the court order was entered.
Huh. Now, who wants to destroy it and why?
Well, that, of course, you really have to ask George Jackson as to why he wants to destroy it and why he has been saying things that aren't true.
Well, tell people.
Also, Wayne Guillebeau of the EDC.
Well, wait. You're kind of talking a little in-groupy here. You got to tell people who George Jackson is and no initials. So start again.
George Jackson is the chief development officer for the city of Detroit.
Right.
He's essentially in charge of development projects, which in Detroit mostly means redevelopment downtown, where you're clearing one site or putting something new in where there used to be something else. And the DEGC is the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation, which is in charge of a lot of this, along with the Detroit Economic Development Corporation, a vice president of which, Wayman Guillebeau, has been doing interviews with the media telling everyone why we have to knock down Tiger Stadium immediately because it's costing so much money, which, in fact, it's costing the city not a penny. The Conservancy has been paying for every penny of maintenance and upkeep for Tiger Stadium for more than 7 months because the city insisted, and we have not run out of money, and we're prepared to do so until at which time we can either close a deal for the project or we decide that we can't make a deal go and then turn it back to the city.
Mm-hmm.
So we're covering the city's costs. In fact, the city upped our fee 2 months ago by $500 a month to account for mowing the grass.
Huh.
So we're paying them to mow the grass. They're not out of pocket.
And so tomorrow there's a court hearing to make an injunction against them permanent. Is that correct?
I, of course, am not an attorney. Our attorneys are going in to ask the temporary restraining order to be continued. I expect that we're asking to continue it till the end of the month, but maybe our attorneys have decided something different. They were working all weekend. I was only working part of the weekend on this. And what we're asking for is a chance to show that we're not, you know, the stadium is not at risk. We're not costing the city anything, despite statements to the contrary. We do have $4 million coming from a federal appropriation to the stadium that will be lost if the stadium is knocked down. So even assuming the city's comments are true, that it's going to save a few hundred thousand dollars, $200,000 or $300,000 in demolition cost to demolish it now rather than later because of the price of the salvageable steel in the structure, then you'd have to subtract that from $3.8 million in federal money that's coming to us that's already been appropriated. So it's sort of Detroit math. Let's see, $300,000 in savings minus $3.8 million we're going to get equals negative $3.5 million. We better knock that down fast. Detroit really doesn't need millions of dollars of federal money.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess a lot of this is going to hinge on what happens tomorrow. Well, could you, Gary, could you, I mean, because we got a lot of, not a lot of conflicting information over the last hour and a half or so, but could you get somebody that for next week and let us know what happens? I mean, a lot of it will probably be in the local papers or on the television, but get back to us. Keep us informed of this.
Sure. I mean, if we lose tomorrow, I expect they will resume demolition immediately and it will all be over with. That is, they will have irreparably damaged the structure so that there, nothing can be done very quickly. In fact, they did serious damage on Friday after the demolition order or the restraining order was given to us. If we succeed, I would be glad to come back on your show and talk about what we're planning on doing and the various developments.
All right. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And thanks for your great work as well. I mean, how can they think about destroying some place where Ty Cobb came flying into second base with spikes, flashing. Babe Ruth hit home runs. Hank Greenberg and Charlie Gerringer and George Kell and, all those people. What is with them? I don't get it. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We are talking about everything under the sun, so if you have something to add or something new to bring up, please do. One of the things we're talking about is Hummer and how Hummer has been bought by a Chinese company, which gives us its word that it's going to keep all the jobs right here in our country. All right, all the profits are going to go out, but at least we'll have those American jobs to make that quintessential symbol of American macho prowess. Although someone said now they're actually symbols of American macho prowess light because the big military model isn't available any longer. But as I said earlier, whatever happened to sleek, right? Here's Jerry. Jerry's in St. Clair Shores. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Great show this evening.
Well, thank you.
I just want to make a quick comment about the Hummer sale. You've probably heard me say this before on your program, but I'm not sure if it was Nikita Khrushchev or Lenin who actually said the capitalists will sell us the ropes with which we'll hang them. These people have appealed to American workers to buy American products for so long, and then after we do our best, our level best, and provide them with the labor to create their wealth, they've sold this country out. I think it's on the level of treason what they've done this to this country. And as goes GM, as goes America, what's next? The American pastime? They'll sell our stadiums, our nostalgia, and everything that we hold valuable and dear.
I mean, there is no foreign ownership of any American sports stadium. That's hard to believe. I got to believe. I mean, they've bought, foreign companies have bought bridges and toll roads and everything under the sun.
Well, I can just see where this is going. I don't know if there actually is or not, but these capitalists and this ownership society have no qualms at all about selling us down the river. It's just a... It's an American tragedy, I feel.
Well, one of the things, and this is what I was talking about, there was in France, the government attempted to do, I can't remember what it was, I think increase the legal work week, and there was a general strike. I mean, they just stopped everything there. And as long, and I'm not putting this off on you, I'm not putting this off on anybody listening, but as long as we're just sitting around watching, we're spectators to our lives being unraveled, this is all going to continue because there's no one saying no with any forceful manner. And as long as it, what did the Godfather say? You know, it's only business, right? At some point, as long as it's only business and it doesn't have any national parameters to it or any ethical parameters to it, they're just going to do whatever they can do. And as long as there's not a countervailing check on this, because apparently there's no group of politicians willing to do it, and it comes to us, as it always has on the major issues of the day, like slavery, like women's votes, like the unionization in the 30s, all of that. I mean, nobody waited around hoping that the elites would do it for us. The average person, the common people, as they were called, did it. And we're just not here. Roger, who knows everything, who's our phone screener, it's Roger and me tonight. He said the Seattle Mariners have Japanese owners, a minority stake. Well, okay. Well, it's an international economy, for one thing. I mean, people would say to you and me, Jerry, that we're being very provincial, very 20th century, almost 19th century to talk about national borders and national loyalties and what have you. It's a world economy. It's globalization. Remember, we thought that was so great. And what, I mean, and we should have seen it coming when it began with NAFTA.
I don't believe that we should sell out social values for the price of a dollar more. I'm a reformed conservative, I guess you can say, and I can remember a book written by William Bennett, who was a great conservative novelist. It was called Our Sacred Honor, and it was taken from a phrase of the Constitution, which says we pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, our sacred honor. And these people have sold our honor. They've sold out lives for what they feel is just a few dollars more. And they play a shell game with us and tell us these things that just aren't true.
Yep. Well, what to do? That's the big question confronting us. But, listen, the first thing that we have to do, and we are there, is to be mad as hell. Then we got to say we're not going to take it anymore, and then we got to start coming up with some answers. And we, as an inventive people, as almost all people are, usually come up with some answers and usually move things forward. That the elites are always the ones that are holding us back. All right, Jerry, thank you very much for bringing that all up.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Some open lines here. Okay, and I want to talk a little about health care some more, but I want to get you folks on the air as well. It's Kathy in Southgate. Hi, Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. Not that it's possibly well-advised, but it is legal in Michigan to openly carry a handgun as long as it's in plain view and holstered. Same rules apply as concealed, that you cannot take them into schools, bars, places of worship, etc. But yes, it is legal to openly carry a holstered handgun.
Wow. What if, like they always would have those shootouts where the guys would walk down the main streets facing one another? And I wonder if that's legal.
Well, obviously, carrying an open gun is kind of an invitation, I would think, just as in Texas, it is legal, and they do have a larger problem with gunfights, I've heard. I have not investigated, but, conventional wisdom is carrying a hand hopefully is inviting trouble. But it is legal, as long as it's in plain view and it is holstered.
Well, I wonder what would be, like, if you're both facing one another and, you know, then you had to quick draw. And what law would you be breaking? Because if you shot somebody that was trying to shoot you, that'd be self-defense. Maybe we could get all these guys that want to carry holsters, you got to get out of it. Like drag racing. You don't want it, like on your street. I'm thinking about this, Kathy. I appreciate the information, though.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. You have a great night.
You too.
Bye-bye. There'd probably be people willing to do that. I mean, you have people wanting to do cage fighting and all that. Here is Ed in Port Huron. Ed, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thanks for joining me on WRIF.
Great. Nice hearing your show. I'd like to talk about all the factory owners around here, and that the biggest expense for them, other than insurance, is the EPA and the OSHA, and that all the countries that import products into us don't have those restrictions against them, and that's why that they can ship products over here that are so much cheaper.
You mean they have the health and safety regulations, the statutory ones and all that?
Yeah, we have all that and they don't, and that's a totally unfair advantage, and that we should charge a tax for any on any products imported here that don't have that, you know, don't have the same regulations.
Well, good. I thought you were going to say that we ought to repeal all the health and safety.
No.
Yeah, no.
No, but we ought to level the playing field.
Yeah, I know. There ought to be any number of ways we level the playing field. I mean, tariffs were always part of the American economy, and they've kind of gone away. And we're dealing with people, for instance, we as a people have decided that there ought to be a certain wage and benefit standard to compensate labor. And the best compensation for industrial work and are unions that have fought to raise compensation way beyond the market value, because the market value, as we see, you can get people to assemble Ford products in Mexico, in Sonora, the state of Sonora, for instance, for $2.50 an hour. And they do an okay job. I mean, those cars, the Fusion and all that, where those are in Hermosillo, isn't that it, or something like that, Mexico. I'm forgetting my cities. But in any event, what the United Auto Workers was able to do was to say, hey, look, we don't think that people should be existing on $2.50 an hour, that we ought to be making like $22.50 an hour. And that's what they've done. So, the tariff ought to be on products from other countries such that it levels the playing field. Good idea. Thank you, Ed.
No, I mean, they don't meet the EPA standards. It costs our companies, you know, millions of dollars to meet up to EPA standards, you know, so they're not polluting the environment.
Right.
And these other countries get away scot-free.
Well, the other thing, you know, there's another aspect to it. Enormous companies, particularly ones like Walmart, they can dictate to manufacturers in other countries what they are going to pay for the product that they buy. I mean, this is the first time in history, probably, unless, you know, maybe gangsters or something like that, that a buyer can dictate to the seller what price they're going to pay. So in order to maintain that low level, I mean, that's where the low prices come from at a place like Walmart. In order to have those low prices, one of the things that they do is the manufacturers in the other countries is they cut corners. They cut corners on safety. They cut corners on environmental considerations and all of that. So we you know, it's, what do they call it, penny wise and pound foolish. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. There are open lines. Grab one, and I'll talk to you when I come back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Get an iPhone 3G? Get the Riff everywhere.
Things are about to get a whole lot better.
Download the free WRIF app today at the iTunes Store. You can stream WRIF live on your iPhone anywhere with just one touch. Details at WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
Do you owe too much money on your credit cards? Do you have over $12,000 in debt and don't know how you'll pay it off? I have a proven program that can help solve your debt problems. I'm Ted Brower, founder of Debt Settlement USA. Credit card debt can cause serious financial hardship, especially if you have loss of income, you're going through a divorce, or you have costly medical bills. Before things get worse, call Debt Settlement USA. We'll show you how to get rid of your debt faster than you think, without bankruptcy and without taking out another loan. Just call Debt Settlement USA right now for a free consultation. Your call is confidential, and there's no obligation.
Call 1-877-560-8877. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, find out how Debt Settlement USA can help you. Not available in all states. Call 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Attention! Hydralyze is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles or bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are eligible to see results and participate in the Hydralyze trial. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away, watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience results with Hydralyze. Call this number today, 1-800-505-7931. Once more, that's 1-800-505-7931.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-337-1442. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-337-1442. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-337-1442. That's 1-800-337-1442.
How harmful is the water in your home? Oh, it may be safe to drink, but it could be damaging your water heater, washing machine, and dishwasher right now. It's a fact. Hard water creates pipe-clogging limescale, and that can be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can safely remove limescale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydroCare, the patented device used worldwide. You simply clip HydroCare to your main water pipe. HydroCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. Guaranteed.
Extremely impressed and happy with the HydroCare unit.
Savings on energy on an average run over 30%.
I'm certain I will get longer life out of my water heater because of it.
Extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydroCare. See for yourself. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com.
Now, Night Call is back. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to the broadcast. This is our final half hour. Jalene Jordan is off tonight. And, man, I got too many. She takes care of a lot of this stuff. I got too much stuff up here on my screen, but I'll try to tell you what's happening. One of the guests is going to be us. This is the interviews I'm going to be broadcasting at 1 a.m. Sasha Abramski, who's written Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It. And also Danny Schechter, editor of MediaChannel.org, and he's going to talk about this recent credit card bill. And some of these, you know, I think, oh, man, that's really exciting, you know, credit card debt, bread lines. But I think that these discussions are pretty lively, or I wouldn't get them on the air. I also think that they're important for us to know this. So I want to get also some of your email. So where the hell did they go? Come on, Jalene, are you listening? Where are they? I don't know. They seem to have disappeared. Oh, here's one. This is from Brian on the Hummer issue. He's writing from Windsor. He wrote it to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Your recent caller mentioned that the Chinese are stealing our jobs, and I just wanted to remind people who to be angry at. Don't hate the Chinese for having the jobs today. Direct that anger towards the man who sent the jobs away. Well, of course, we got to know that. And there is one important one here. I don't know. Where the hell is it? But there's someone, Joe from Farmington Hills, said, I'm not here to defend Walmart, but I always hear how you say Walmart can afford to pay people more than they currently do. That is really not true. Blow us some facts on Walmart and what you propose. But it's too long for me to get through. And but, you know, they always say, I mean, this is one of the most profitable corporations in the world. You don't think they can pay more than $7 an hour or $8 an hour and no benefits? Come on. Come on. They ought to be able to do that, and they ought to be able to pay their suppliers in other countries a decent wage as well. But, Joe, I will, I'll read through that when I'm off the air. All right, there are open lines at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. And here's Fred. Fred's in Sterling Heights. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. This is Frank from Sterling Heights.
Oh, Frank. Okay.
Yeah. I read an interesting story, was disturbing about a couple months ago in the Scientific American, and outlined a story that the Chinese had bought about 20% of a company that was based in Indiana that had developed technology for magnets that were used in gyroscopes for missile defense and also space applications.
Uh-huh.
And it was approved by our government as long as they only went 20%. But after about a year, nobody was watching them. They took 51% of the company over through stock purchase. And then they moved the technology and the equipment to make these specialized magnets back to China. And also they retained the patent rights to it. And now we have to depend on buying these magnets from them for our missiles.
I love it.
Yeah. So it was pretty disturbing just to hear, you know, some of that was going on and the government wasn't watching it. But
well, they have such an excess amount of cash. I mean, in some ways, fortunate for us because beginning under the Bush regime, who sold us down the drain in terms of taking a surplus in the budget and turning it into a deficit. And so now we're being financed, not entirely, but to the tune of trillions of dollars that the Chinese have bought. And so they have us by the cojones, as they say in some parts of the world, right?
That's right. They're not only moving the jobs over, they're purchasing all of the technology and the rights to it. So, I mean, even if we wanted to start producing it again, they would have us in the World Trade Order saying that it's their patent now.
Yep. All right, Frank, thank you very much.
Okay, thank
bye
you.
Bye now. Thanks for joining us with that piece of sad news. 313-298-WRIF. You know, part of the problem is about where this money could, well, the problem is where the money comes from is us, where it goes. Nothing is ever said about the war budget, the U.S. war budget, and the cost of wars. Here's an article from the AP. Major problems found in war spending. Oh, wow. This is one Christmas gift that U.S. taxpayers don't need. Construction, are you ready for this? Construction of a $30 million dining facility at a U.S. base in Iraq, which is scheduled to be completed on December 25th. Maybe George Bush can go over there with a turkey. But the decision to build it was based on bad planning and botched paperwork. It's not their money. What do they care, right? It's just a big loot fest. The project is too far along to stop, of course, making the mess hall a future monument to the waste and inefficiency plaguing the war effort, according to an independent panel investigating contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan. In its first report to Congress, the Wartime Contracting Commission presents a bleak assessment of how tens of billions of dollars have been spent since 2001. Isn't that pretty? All of Bush's buddies got wealthy, and we wound up with an economy that's sinking, and our tax dollars are paying for all of this. And it's like this. This is looting. This is a wealth transfer. You know, all these conservatives are always saying when somebody like Obama says he wants to raise the tax on the ultra wealthy, like by 1%, they say, oh, it's income distribution, redistribution, it's socialism. Well, of course it's income redistribution. If you make the ultra wealthy pay another 1%, you're cutting into their wealth by that much. But this is, too, this is a wealth distribution of looting, essentially, that takes money from you and me, and it transfers it through the agency of the government to these contractors that are all buddies with the Bush administration, and for all I know, it's funny, a lot of this hasn't been reported. Now, I don't know if it's also buddies with the Obama administration, but probably some of it remains absolutely intact. Where are they going to find new contractors that know how to pour cement, for instance? So, well, let's get some ones that aren't looting the American taxpayer. Oh, yeah, okay. Where are they? What's their phone number? Let's see. This report documents poor management, weak oversight, and a failure to learn from past mistakes as recurring themes in wartime contracting. Well, the reason that they have a failure to learn from past mistakes is they don't care. It's not their money. And, in fact, it works well for them because they can just screw up, screw up, screw up. And so what? It's way over budget. And what happens if it's way over budget? If there's in civilian contractors, state contractors and whatever, if they go in over budget, they have to eat it usually. Not always, but frequently. And if someone says they're going to replace your driveway, lay concrete, and they say they want $4,000, and you sign a contract for $4,000, and they come to you and say, it's already cost me $4,200. I need another $1,800 to make my payroll. You go, hey, man, you signed this. You say anybody can lay concrete. The skill is in the bidding. But these people don't care because it's all part of the process of looting. Let's see. U.S. reliance on contractors has grown to, quote, unprecedented proportions, according to the Bipartisan Commission. More than 240,000 private sector employees are supporting military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the government has no central database on who all these contractors are, what services they provide, and how much they're paid. The Pentagon has failed to provide enough trained staff to watch over them, creating conditions for waste and corruption, the commission says. So we're being taken. We're being fleeced. We're being looted. A lot of our money. I mean, of all the things that these rich suits did to screw up the economy, they probably thought what they were doing was going to last forever. They were just not as smart as they thought. These people are consciously involved in criminal activity. Few of them have been brought to justice. But this was something that was put in motion by the Bush gang. And just probably ought to be listed. Another thing to be listed on their indictment when they finally get tried for all their crimes. Haha, right, as if they're ever going to. All right, let's go to Detroit. This is Watts.
Peter.
Is this the Watts that goes way back into the Peter Werbe talk shows?
Yes, sir. You bet your sweet baby.
How you doing, man?
Okay.
Good.
Hey, I recently heard about a book that came out in the 90s titled Confessions of a Union Buster. Are you familiar with that, and what do you think of it?
Well, the title sounds familiar, and it probably is the process whereby when people at a workplace sign enough cards to say they want an election, they bring in these firms that advise the employer how to destroy the effort that people are putting forth to get decent wages and better benefits.
Yeah, especially with that vote coming up soon. And I was wondering, you might want to entertain the thought of, looking into that book and if it's good, interviewing that guy.
Well, what is it, the Employee Free Choice Act, isn't that it? EFCA, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That would mean, and it's something like they have in Canada, that if there was enough cards signed, people indicating they wanted to join a union, that 50% would be enough to make it the union that would then be established. And suddenly, like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, led by no other than, do we know who that is, Watts?
I forget now. Then.
John Engler.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
That they say, oh, my God, this would rob the American worker of his democratic choice of whether he wanted a union or not.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a little solution for you and the rest of the listeners, and that is, the small things. Big things start with small things. So what I've been doing lately is when I go to pay a gas bill, you know, at the gas station or whatever. I tell as many people as possible, just real quick, saying, say, well, hey, you know, you look like you're a hardworking person like myself, and are you familiar with, like, such shows as yourself or PBS Now, Bill Moyers Journal, MSNBC, Ed Schultz, Keith Olbermann, you know, Richard Maddow, and especially Air America's Tom Hartman, and, you know, tell them about that.
What do they say? You usually start talking to people with more than one sentence. Like I was in my local Citgo station, and what is it up to now? Almost 289 or something. Up north, it's over $3 again. And I just say, we're getting robbed again. And everybody goes, uh-huh. But if you start really talking to them, watch, how do they react?
Actually, you know, I usually try and drop just like maybe one, like show, and not to diss anybody because I think all those, you know, your shows and everybody else's is excellent, but especially as far as being positive is Air America's Tom Hartman. And because he has, well, he's got more time, to be fair, and he's got solutions, and he tells people, you know, go to, you know, like you do, but, you know, call congress.org, and there's like a toll-free number. I wish I had it right now, because some people don't have, you know, with the economic times, you know, it costs X amount of money, and some people don't have computers, like myself, and on and on and on, or, you know, their computers break or whatever. And at least it's doing something instead of nothing,
yeah.
Something positive.
Well, Hartman and his breadth of knowledge is absolutely astounding. Every time I listen to his show, I mean this sincerely, I feel like a dope. I feel like I don't know anything compared to this. You know, my little mantra, I say I know a little and I can guess the rest after the title of that Leonard Skinner song. But this man knows so much. I mean, he writes books. He writes books after. You know what Tom Hartman's secret is and why I'll never be as knowledgeable as him? I sleep. He doesn't. I'm serious.
I believe it.
I'm serious. How can this guy, I mean, at some points he was doing two shows. He writes books. He lectures. He goes all around the world. He's written books about ADD. He writes books about the Constitution. He scares me, but yeah. You're right. He's a buddy of mine, and I have the highest regard for him.
Yeah, he's totally mind-boggling, and actually, I thank you because you're the one who turned me on to him years ago on your show. You interviewed him.
Oh, really? Well, I do from time to time. I mean, he writes books on, like, walking meditation, or he'll write a book on, like I say, on the Constitution, or on some facet of constitutional law that created the capacity for corporations to buy government.
Mm-hmm. The only criticism I have of yours is, if you call it criticism, you know, I think you're great and all that, but just talk it up a little bit about, you know, about Air America and Tom Hartman and, like, call congress.org. So, you know, I recently called, you know, my senator, and I hadn't done that in some time, and it took like 5 minutes, and I felt good about it. And I'm actually trying to do something. I'm actually doing something. And that's all we have is, you know, we have to fight all this power and money. But it's like, it sounds corny, but it's people power that will do it.
Actually, every time I call, I usually call my representative, who I hate, mm-hmm. and a Democrat. And every time I get done talking to someone in his office, I just feel angry. You know, the only time I'll tell you that we get a good hearing from him is you're having a demonstration. I mean, as an individual, it's hard to do, but if you're get hooked up, I mean, you know, you can get hooked up easy enough. I mean, there are so many efforts out there that are so far below the radar that most people, I'm sure, listening to this don't even know exist. Things that they care about the economy, about a national health program, about any aspect of peace and social justice. And you go to some of their offices with, 30 or 40 people, and all of a sudden, well, welcome. Well, come in. The representative would like to hear from you. And we're always interested in what constituents have to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Watts, sorry.
Yeah, and I have to say, at least it's, at least it's doing something, and turn off the TV for 5 minutes. You know, I like movies and music and TV and sports and all that stuff. But, you know, at least 5 minutes, you know, every once in a while, you know.
Indeed. All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Bye, Watts. Thanks for being on around for so long. Yeah, you know, I remember the phrase. Probably, I don't think everyone listens to this from noon till, or I guess, what am I talking about? 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. But I said, I was thinking about how much television that I watch, and I remember what I used to say about it, that people say that television is mindless entertainment. And I usually say that's what it's actually good for, because that's what I want to see, a movie. I might want to see, who was this? Did I mention this? What the hell is the name of that film? Where those little toy cars come to life. Transformers. Yeah, I love that one. Or the, you know, Bourne Ultimatum. Or the Wings. That's mindless in the sense that, and that's good. You know, you don't always have to be engaged. I mean, I don't do what I'm doing on this show 24/7. I like to, like you, kick back and not have to think about everything awful in the world. So, that all said, let me get on to another call here. Let's see. It is Mike. Mike's calling from Washington Township. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good.
Okay. I was calling in. I heard that lady talk about carrying a gun in a holster.
Yeah.
I know in Utica, out there in the north part of Macomb County, there is a law like that, but it's so old. Try doing that, you're going to wind up in jail so fast, it's not even funny.
That's what I would think.
Because I drive a semi-truck, and I used to go to Texas a lot. I actually thought about moving down there because I was there so much. And the police, like in Fort Worth and Dallas, if you're carrying a gun, you're not going to last maybe 5 minutes. And down there, you'll probably wind up in jail because everybody goes to jail down there for everything. You know, they got a massive prison complex.
I think they do. I think that if police see a gun displayed, in fact, there's any... Yeah, what happened to all the police officers? They usually call. If they're, in fact, I don't even know if I have time a bit left. But if they saw somebody walking down the street, if somebody was walking down the street in Washington Township or Southgate or Ferndale with a loaded six gun strapped to their waist, I think you're right, Mike. I think they'd be.
Well, I think it's brandishing a firearm in public, the actual technicality of it. I don't know. I have guns, but I'm an idiot, and I just, shoot them and keep them in the closet where I'm supposed to, locked up. But, yeah, you're asking for trouble. And the other thing I was calling about was NAFTA. I'm 30 years old. I'll be 31 this year. I'm getting married, and, I still have our jobs leaving. And my family owned a factory in the 80s, and, the big, they're stamping out parts of the big three, and they ran them out of business. They came back every year, 25% cheaper, 25% cheaper. I remember, it was 901 spot welding on 10 Mile. I remember seeing, I was down there with my dad, stamping out parts. He'd let me watch and stuff. And they knew NAFTA and all these things they're doing with other countries would run us into this situation. If they didn't know, they're stupid and they shouldn't be in office.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what are we going to do?
Well, I don't know.
Like you said, who are you going to vote for? They're all crooked. To be a politician, you pretty much got to be on the take at the national level.
You know what I always think in terms of things like NAFTA? Pardon me. It's I see the image of, they say once the toothpaste is out of the tube, how do you get it back in, right?
Oh, exactly. Once they pass a law, getting it repealed is killer.
Or not even so much the laws, but the jobs. The jobs you got. So you're saying that the big three was able to dictate, in the way I was mentioning earlier, was able to dictate what they'll pay.
Yeah, because my great-grandpa helped start the union at Ford when he came over from Italy. He was a worker, and, guys were getting killed at work, their hands ripped off, and just they're working them like dogs for nothing, which I'm sure you know.
Sure.
And they started the union, and even he said before he died, my dad told me, the union strayed so far from what it was supposed to be that they kind of helped orchestrate their own demise.
Well, they needed to be, they've needed to be for years and years, more confrontational, and instead they've just rolled over. All right, Mike, I got to go.
All right, well, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks for being our last caller tonight. And the reason I got to go is I think my voice tonight is coming to an end. Where the hell did I get a cold from in June? It is way beyond me, but so it goes. You'll, if you stay tuned, and I hope you will, you'll hear me in fine form as I air after just a few minutes at 1 a.m. A couple of very interesting interviews about credit card debt, another one about hunger in America, and I will be all fixed up by next week. Jalene Jordan will be back. I want to thank all of you for listening and for calling. Roger, it's been Roger and me tonight. Thank you so much for answering the phones, and stay tuned.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
The home of WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and where Riff is rocking the streets. Check out Motor City's Deals and Deals and get stuff for half price. Or hear 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Website.
Websites worldwide.
101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
You may have seen her on Oprah or The View. We're talking to Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center, about a powerful free tape she's giving away to help people discover a way to leave anxiety and depression behind for good. Lucinda, what are some of the symptoms of anxiety?
Worry, fear, depression, insecurity, low self-esteem. I suffered with anxiety and depression for over 20 years. When I was at my lowest point, I was curled up in a ball on my living room sofa, afraid to live and afraid to die.
Wow. So what's the biggest anxiety myth?
I think the most challenging thing about working with people with anxiety and depression is that many of them think they're victims of their emotions. They think they'll always be worrisome, fearful, and depressed.
But that's not true.
There's real drug-free help that has the potential to last a lifetime. Millions of people have called for this wonderful free tape.
Okay. To request your free tape, call 1-800-550-6146. 1-800-550-6146. 1-800-550-6146.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby with you. We are in hard times, as everyone says. I've certainly done a number of shows about the origins of our economic crisis, the dimensions of it, and we learn more and more of its aspects now that people that are above subprime loans are vulnerable to foreclosures because of the loss of jobs. The impact on all of this is still unknown to us. We don't know whether we are in 1933, which would be the height of the 30s depression, or whether we're in 1929 and things are going to actually get a lot worse. One thing we do not associate, with this recession, you're not supposed to say depression, recession, is hunger. That there is hunger afoot in this country, and it's not just started as of the economic troubles. The book I'm looking at is Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger, and the good news in the subtitle is How to Fix It. My guest is Sasha Abramsky, and he's a journalist and a senior fellow at Demos, a policy research and advocacy organization in New York. His work has appeared in lots of places, The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, Village Voice, Rolling Stone. You may remember our last conversation with him. I think it was a couple of years ago, 2007 it was. His book was American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. He's at his home in Sacramento, California. It's a pleasure to welcome back Sasha Abramsky. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, we always we get the wonderful British accent. So you give us a quick bio on that.
Yeah, I grew up in London. I moved to America when I was about 21, and I have lived here for the last 16 years doing journalism on both coasts, in New York and now in California.
And your mother is American?
My mother's from California originally, yeah, so I guess I'm something of a homing pigeon. I basically came back from to where I had my roots.
There you go. Well, one of the things here, we're talking about the hidden scandal of American hunger and how to fix it. Your book's called Breadline USA, and the breadline is an iconic image of the 1930s, usually men with those fedora hats on, but it was the poor, of course, who suffered the worst in that period and could be now as well. But one of the things, when we look at the poor today, they don't look like they're starving. In fact, obesity is often a feature of poverty. What bring us this all into focus?
Yeah, I mean, The iconic imagery you're talking about from the 1930s is iconic because there were a few photographers who spent a lot of time chronicling it. There were people like Walker Evans and James Agee, a writer-photographer combination. There was Dorothy Lange. There were people who really made it a mission to bring home the scale of the economic disaster and to personalize it and humanize it. And that's sort of what I'm trying to do in my book, Redline USA, because my idea is that there's a tremendous cascading crisis, and we've seen it unfold at breakneck speed in the last year, but it's a crisis that's been building and that's been hitting many, many people for many, many years. And it's a crisis that's caused by a stagnating minimum wage. It's a crisis that's caused by rising unemployment in Detroit. That's a huge problem at the moment. Detroit and California, two of the places in the country that lead the way with unemployment. There's a crisis of healthcare access, where people have jobs but they don't have health insurance, and if they get sick, all their discretionary spending goes on buying medicine or seeing a doctor. There was the problem last year when gas prices soared and people had jobs, but if they were earning $5 or $6 or $7 an hour, they were spending a third of their income by the end of last summer just filling their car with gas to get to work. And again, the thing that gave was they didn't have enough money left over for food. So my book is an exploration of all of these forces. I call it trickle-up poverty. It starts at the bottom, but it percolates upwards and it affects more and more people. And at this point, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have either been to food banks or they fear they might at some point have to go to food banks because they cannot afford food. So we have 35 million people in this country on food stamps. We have tens of millions of people who would qualify for food stamps but don't get them. We have tens of millions of people who they don't have food stamp access, but they do use food banks and food pantries. And so my book is an attempt to explore what's going on here, how so many people in a country that thinks of itself as being awash in food really struggle these days to put food on the table for themselves and, more importantly, for their children.
Mm-hmm. And a country that I haven't heard this recently, but it still is the wealthiest country in the world. It's just, you're talking about trickle-up poverty. The wealth doesn't trickle down like it's supposed to.
We're still the wealthiest country in the world, at least in part because the economic crisis has made everybody poorer. So we still have the largest piece of a smaller pie at this point.
Well, all right. So you've laid out the contemporary Breadline USA, the title of your new book from Polypoint Books. But in the subtitle, it says The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger. And I think most people are saying, wait a minute. Now, maybe people don't have the money to get food, but there's food banks, and here in Michigan, the Gleaners, and everybody else. Hunger means you not only...
Hunger means there are two different parts of hunger, and I think I need to explain this. What there isn't in America is the kind of hunger that we saw in Ethiopia, let's say, 20 years ago, when there was a famine, and there were these images on television of children with bloated bellies and that sort of thing. We don't have that kind of hunger in this country. We have at various points in our history. If you go back to the 19th century, there were periods when there were food shortages in parts of the country. Anyone who's familiar with California history will know the story of the Donner Party, where there was literally starvation among the pioneers. But those are isolated incidents. What's much more common than that kind of level of hunger in America is gnawing food insecurity or anxiety about where to eat, how to eat, how to get money for food, and it becomes all-consuming. One of the things I did in my book, I talked to many, many hundreds of people around the country who were living on extraordinarily low amounts of money. I spoke to a woman called Abricia Edick. She worked for Walmart. She was earning about $8 or $9 an hour, and her hours were being cut and cut and cut. So at some point last year, she was down to about 25 hours a week. After taxes, she was bringing home about $200 a week. And she literally was down to about $15 a week that she had available to buy food. She wasn't starving, but she was living on the kind of food that nobody who's working full-time should have to live on. She was literally living on cans of outdated soup. She couldn't afford meat. She couldn't afford vegetables. She couldn't afford fruit. Not surprisingly, she had no energy, because whatever little energy she had was going to thinking about and preparing these very measly meals. Now, I interviewed a lot of people like that, and I then realized, look, I can talk to as many people as I like, but at a certain point, I need to experience this myself. So I put myself on a low-income budget. I calculated what I would earn if I was earning the medium wage for a McDonald's worker, which was $8.23 an hour last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a series of permutations. I phoned my accountant and I worked out, what are my tax obligations? I talked to a whole bunch of people in low-income situations. I said, what are you spending on rent? What are you spending on car insurance? What are you spending on gas? And I calculated what I'd have left over for food. And then I tweaked my budget a few times. I added a certain amount of money extra when gas prices went up. I said, all right, what happens if I have a small emergency, a flat tire for my car, and I have to spend a few dollars that week fixing it? And I tweaked my budget in certain ways. What I found was that as soon as one or two things start to go wrong for that worker on $8.23 an hour, they've got less available for food than if they were unemployed and on food stamps. It's a trap of working poverty. And you can't really live on the kinds of money that's available. I ended up in certain weeks with about $15 for a week's worth of food. That includes everything. That includes coffee, it includes tea, it includes all 21 meals in the week. And if you can live on $15 or $16 a week, you end up living very, very badly, and you end up with no energy, and you end up feeling depressed, and you end up feeling low, with a low level of chronic sickness, chronic fatigue.
Did you do this? I
did this over a two-month period while I was writing parts of the book, and I ran my budget by a food nutritionist at UC Davis, and she told me, you know, all right, you're doing this right, you're doing this wrong, here are the long-term health implications. And it was really interesting to me because I'm a healthy, relatively young man. If I were older, if I were sicker, if I were female and pregnant, if I were younger and had certain nutritional needs, children have separate nutritional needs. In those cases, the budget I was on and the food I was able to eat on that budget would have had very deleterious health consequences. And that's why my book's about hunger, because this really isn't just about poor people not getting the kind of food they want. It's about poor people with such strictures on their diet that they're actually sacrificing their health at this point.
Mm-hmm. The book is Breadline USA. Sasha Abramsky is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. And you rigorously stuck to this diet.
I had two kids, and my four-year-old daughter was extremely worried that she called it a food bidget. She was extremely worried that I was going to starve myself. When I did it, I put out a separate shelf of my pantry, a separate shelf of my fridge, a separate shelf of my freezer just for my food. And so I'd have my sort of, you know, measly little amounts of food, tiny quantities of rice and beans, maybe one or two bananas to last me for a week. That would be my fresh fruit. I'd have maybe one bottle of iced tea as my sort of luxurious soft drink for an entire week. And I really was calculating all the time as to how I would prepare my next meal, when I would eat. It became very all-consuming.
Hmm.
Now, contrary to my daughter's worry, my project wasn't about starvation. There actually was a project about 65 years ago. At the very tail end of World War II, a nutritionist called Ansel Keys starved about 50 volunteers at the University of Minnesota. And his point was literally to see, what do you do if a body breaks down because of lack of access to food, and then how do you rebuild the body? And that was a devastating experiment. He starved 50 young conscientious objectors for several months. I had no intention of doing that. My intent was the opposite. It was, how do you avoid starvation? How do you avoid hunger?
Well, Sasha,
in the kind of low-income situation that millions of Americans are in today.
Let me ask. Well, that actually is part of my question as well, the last clause that I kind of spoke over. But just on a personal level, as a researcher, as a writer, you could have fudged it. You know, you could have. Why didn't you? Why didn't you just kind of do it for a couple of days and do it a little halfway? And
you know, because
you could report the same thing.
Because part of the problem is that it's cumulative. You can live for a couple of days. Everybody does it at times. If you go on a camping trip, if you're a student and you run out of money, everybody lives at times with not quite enough food. If you do it for a couple of days, it has no consequences at all. But if that is your life, if your life and your life's horizons are defined by lack of access to food and by anxiety about where you're going to get enough money to buy food, in addition to it having physical effects, it has mental effects. It tends to lead to depression, to withdrawal, to isolation. And I realized at a certain point, I was up in Northern California. I was interviewing people at food pantries in a very poor part of Northern California. And I went back to my hotel, and I put on my TV, and I watched a film, an old Gregory Peck movie called Gentleman's Agreement.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a great old film. Gregory Peck plays a journalist, and he wants to write an expose about anti-Semitism. And he talks to a lot of his Jewish friends, and he gets their stories. And he realizes at a certain point he can hear all he likes about their stories, but the only way he's going to know what it feels like to be at the wrong end of anti-Semitism is to pass himself off as Jewish and see how people treat him. So he passes himself off as Jewish, and he tries to check into hotels that don't allow Jews and so on. And he ends up with this extraordinary insight into what it feels like to be a Jew at the wrong end of anti-Semitic attacks. And I watched this movie, and I thought, you know what, that's exactly what I need to do. I'm going to tell the story of American hunger. And especially, you said, you know, a lot of people think, oh, poor people, they have enough to eat, they're just not good at planning their food, you know, they get fat, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lack of empathy there. And I thought, if I want to tell the story, if I want to humanize this story, if I want to make people know what it feels like to be one of those 30 or 40 million Americans who worries about food all the time, I need to know what it feels like. And the only way I can do that is if I go onto this kind of food diet. So that's why I did this for 2 months period.
Well, there is a level of social contempt for the obese, even though we we're one of the more obese countries in the world. So it's not, people think it's like so many other things. It's individual choice. But when it takes on a mass expression, a mass cultural and social and class expression, obesity in this case, there's some root to it other than the individual choice of how much food or what food you put in your mouth.
Absolutely. I mean, President Obama talks a lot about empathy. And I think empathy is a crucial thing when you're talking about the lives that poor people lead, because oftentimes the choices they make, you're right, they lead to manifestations, maybe obesity, etc., that other people dislike and loathe and find contemptuous. And you've got to ask yourself, what is happening here? Well, one of the things that's happening is if you're a poor person worried about food, if you have money, you do two things. One, you tend to buy as much food as you can as a sort of binge-purge cycle. And the second thing is you tend to buy food that gives you the biggest calorie bang for the buck. Now, what that means is if you only have a dollar or two and you need to get food in your belly, you get food that fills you up. You get corn chips. You get hot dogs. You get cheap, affordable, high-calorie food that over the long run will tend to lead to obesity. You don't get healthy food. You don't get fruit. You don't get vegetables. You don't get yogurts and so on, because that costs money. And to fill your stomach up, you have to spend more money than you tend to have available. And this is what I found over the 7-8 weeks that I did my hunger experiment. This is exactly what I found, that when I had money, I spent it on the wrong kinds of food because those foods filled me up. And they gave me a temporary relief from the hunger I was experiencing. And once you realize that, once you realize that people are eating that kind of food and are getting into that kind of health situation, at least in part because of poverty, that changes the equation. It changes the way you understand the problem. It changes the kind of solutions that you propose for this.
Sure. Breadline USA is the book. The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It is the subtitle. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Sasha Abramsky, and it's published by Polypoint Press. You can go to breadlineusa.com to get a further look at the book online, and there'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. There's an old saying, poor people have poor habits, so there's often the temptation to lecture, and probably correctly, that the poor ought to make better choices. I don't know why that the founder of one of these pizza places, which is also out of my brain at the moment as well, Domino's, that he said that he was raised on surplus commodities, what used to be given to poor people rather than food stamps. And he said, you know, he lectured the poor, this billionaire, that if you made good choices, if you made food from scratch. I just heard someone say, by the way, never ingest food that in which the ingredients are listed on a package. But he said, you know, do everything from scratch. Use whole grains. Don't, on and on. Look for bargains. Don't buy corn chips. Don't buy, Spam and what have you. How do you react to that?
I think he's right in the abstract that if you have a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of motivation, you can live quite well, quite cheaply. One of the things I found was if you have a car, it's much easier to live cheaply. And the reason for that is if you have the ability to drive to farmers markets or to drive to little roadside stalls where fresh fruit and vegetables are sold, you can buy a lot of produce for a very reasonable amount of money. So one week I said, I'm going to use my car, and I drove out about 10 or 15 miles. And for $11, I got enough good fruit and vegetables to last me a week. The problem is an awful lot of poor people don't have cars. So they're restricted to what they can get to on public transport and what they can carry home on public transport. They generally don't even do that. They go to their neighborhood store, which usually doesn't have fresh produce, or if it does, it's very overpriced. Usually what it has is a lot of very high sugar, high salt produce, a lot of canned produce. So they buy that not because they want to, but because it's the easiest, quickest thing to do. So your billionaire that you quote is right. If you have the luxury of time and of motivation and of education, you can do better. But a lot of poor people are trapped in this cycle. They don't have the knowledge about what kinds of food are healthy. They don't have the transport to get to cheap food sources. And they're also isolated and depressed because of their poverty, and they're tired. They oftentimes work one or two jobs, more than full-time employment, and yet they're not making ends meet. They work 12 or 14 hours a day. They come home, they've got to prepare food for their kids, and they don't have the energy to spend the time that it takes to prepare the kind of meal that your billionaire talks about. And I think your readers, your listeners will empathize with this, that if you're exhausted and if you're depressed, and if you're impoverished, and if you're worried about where your next paycheck's coming from, none of that is conducive to making the kinds of choices that result in healthy living.
Sure.
And that's a huge problem, and that actually sort of brings me to the subtitle of my book, How Do You Fix This Problem?
Sure.
And I think you don't fix it just by throwing more money into food programs. Those are Band-Aids. What you do is you fix it by approaching this from the side. You look at the underlying reasons that are triggering hunger or triggering food anxiety. One of those underlying reasons is we haven't adjusted the minimum wage properly in recent years. So we've got a whole bunch of people at or near the minimum wage. They're working full-time, they're playing by the rules, and yet they're running backwards. However hard they work, they're still not able to pay their bills. A week before the month ends, they've run out of money and they've run out of food. They end up on the food pantry lines. So one fix to this would be you raise the minimum wage. Another fix would be, look, if you've got a lot of poor people in rural areas who have to drive to work, and if gas prices are spiking, you've got to find a way to subsidize gas for those people.
Subsidize
the buying of more fuel-efficient vehicles. If you don't do that, people are going to put money in their cars to buy gas, and they're not going to have enough money for food.
Let me interrupt you just one second, because I agree with you completely, and I was thinking about subsidized gas. Like, for instance, gasoline forever in Venezuela, way before Hugo Chavez, has been 14 cents a gallon. I mean, this got some other problems attendant with it.
Well, the problem with that is it's 14 cents a gallon for everybody.
Yeah,
exactly. And that sends all the wrong signals, because there are problems with a gasoline-based economy, and it's a finite resource. B, you know, everyone knows about greenhouse gases.
But what I was saying was that that's not an item where a poor person has to worry about paying $4.50 a gallon.
That's
and
right.
As it is, gas prices are beginning to go up. I just looked and I said, wait a minute, how did it get to be $2.60
here in California? We're up to $3 almost again.
You know, remind me of this, is I can't think of the billionaire's name, and now the first point you made was about food was just a second ago. Are we both? Never mind. Well, let me get you back on. Okay, Sasha Bromsky, you know, there's a Bob Dylan line. I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane. I think that's true with both of us. Hey, let me just get you back on track. I wanted to quote, and this has to do with what you're talking about, the root of hunger. In one of the sheets that came with your book, Breadline USA, it says people in the third world regularly go hungry because of failed crops and general food shortages. Now, this isn't really so. I mean, usually what the problem of hunger and starvation in the world is not that there is not food available. It's access to food.
It's access.
People do not have the money to pay for it. They just like you were saying here.
Yeah, it depends where you're talking about and when you're talking about. If you go back into the sort of not too distant past, India used to be racked with tremendous famines, and that was when, you know, crops failed and huge numbers of people go hungry. In more recent years, India's hunger is more similar to America's. The food is there. They had the Green Revolution. It increased the amount of produce available. What isn't there is the money evenly distributed around the country so that people can afford to access food markets. You know, that same thing holds true in America. Today, we're a country of abundance. When I was reporting my book, I went to one of those food fests where there are competitions for who can eat fried asparagus the fastest, and it's sort of grotesque. You stand there, you watch seven or eight grown men stuff 6 or 7 pounds of asparagus down their throats in a couple minutes. It's absolutely vile to watch. It's apparently a great spectator sport, though, because it gets huge crowds, but that struck me sort of very emblematic that clearly we're not a country that worries about how much food we have available, because no country that really was worried about food availability would have food eating competitions. What we have is a tremendous problem with access, and this used to be a problem that was sort of so invisible because it really was just the underclasses, the poorest of the poor, and it was a terrible story for them, but it didn't impact the broader public directly. And in the last few years, as the economy has sort of, well, I guess wobble is too weak a word, as the economy has fallen off a cliff in many parts of the country, Detroit being a case in point, a tremendous number of people who used to think of themselves as relatively financially stable now find two things. One, they're worried about their financial status, and secondly, they just can't keep up anymore, and they're not able to buy enough food for their family. And that's a problem of access, and it demands policy solutions that fix the access rather than increase food supplies.
Well, Sasha Abramsky, we only have about 2 minutes left. It's a big problem, and so we got to talk about policy legislation. Who has access to food? Who has access to a living wage? Is any of that on the agenda nationally?
Yeah, this is why I'm actually relatively optimistic in the long run about this. Poverty is one of those issues that
if you put the federal government behind it, you can do a lot. If the federal government raises the minimum wage by a couple dollars an hour, which was in Obama's policy manifesto, you actually impact the lives not just of people on the minimum wage, but of people in the next tier up who are in jobs that are pegged as being $2 or $3 above whatever the minimum wage is. So that's a technocratic fix, but it would have a tremendous impact. If you have a government, either at a state level or a federal level, really committed to getting more people more affordable health care, well, then you're going to have a whole bunch of people who, instead of worrying about going into bankruptcy if they have to go to the emergency room, those people have access to health care. And instead of worrying about whether they can afford food or fill a prescription, they'll get their prescription and they'll still be able to afford food. That's a policy fix. It's eminently achievable at the moment. Same thing with gas. We're not going to be able to get back to a situation where gas is always $1 or $2 a gallon. We probably shouldn't get back to that situation. But while we're transitioning to a cleaner, greener economy, we can put in place policy subsidies that provide a measure of relief to people who are poor, especially people who are poor and in rural areas who need to drive to work. We could have something equivalent to the food stamp program for gas. We could call it a gas stamps program. That's a policy fix. So these things are achievable. Some of them are being implemented at the moment in D.C. Others are being implemented in experimental programs at a state level. I am optimistic that we have a government at the moment that cares about these issues. And I think, as I said again, empathy is a large part of this. Once you understand these stories, once you understand why so many people are struggling to feed their families, and once you care about that and say, look, this is a national disgrace, then you can put a lot of political energy into fixing that. And I think we're starting to see some of that happening at the moment.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Our guest has been Sasha Abramsky. The book is Breadline USA, and the website for it is breadlineusa.com. There'll be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. The subtitle is The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It. It's published by Polypoint Press. You can go to p3books.com. They have a good list of other books at the end. And I would say that listeners who are low income, that you, if you can, go to the website of the Department, the Michigan Department of Human Resources, now that it's headed by a wonderful man, Ishmael Ahmed. He is anxious to get everyone possible that deserves food stamps enrolled. They also have the kind of innovative projects that Sasha Abramsky has been talking about. Thanks so much for being with us.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
The future is here. We do not need to be afraid anymore.
From your iPhone 3G, download the free WRIF app at the iTunes Store. It gives you one-touch access to WRIF streaming live wherever you are. Get more details at WRIF.com.
The riff. Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees, having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
I looked at her, and I was just, wow, she looked so young.
I told her I couldn't believe how smooth her face looks. She's lost, what, 10 years at least?
I look at her, and it's like I'm looking at a picture of my wife from 20 years ago. It's incredible.
How are ordinary women across America looking years younger? They've discovered the proven breakthrough called Hydroxytone. It erases wrinkles, tightens skin, and makes frown lines disappear from view. See for yourself by requesting a free trial of Hydroxytone today. The results are so impressive. Hydroxytone was given away in VIP gift bags at international film festivals. Try Hydroxytone risk-free and shed years from your appearance faster than you thought possible.
She always looked good to me, but now I can't believe how young she looks.
Call now for your free trial of Hydroxytone. For a limited time, try it before you buy it. 1-800-630-3327. But hurry, when this offer's gone, it's gone. Call 1-800-630-3327. 1-800-630-3327.
Here's more Direct Talk from DirecTV. Today, we're talking stimulus, specifically great TV at a great price kind of stimulus. With DirecTV, enjoy 100% digital picture and sound, including most sports, the greatest movies, and all your local channels. Packages start at just $29.99 a month, and you can lock in your price for a year. With no startup costs and 99.9% digital signal reliability, DirecTV has had higher customer satisfaction ratings than cable. 8 years in a row. If you're in need of a TV stimulus plan, call 1-888-359-5566. Call right now and ask about free next day installation. Call 1-888-359-5566. That's 1-888-359-5566. Offer ends 7709. New DirecTV customers only, subject to credit approval. Call for details. Among the largest national cable and satellite TV providers, 2008 American Customer Satisfaction Index, University of Michigan Business School.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. You know, I remember, not so long ago, people would blithely say, yeah, I'm maxed out on my credit card. And slowly over the last year and a half or two, maybe a little more, people began to really get the very solid idea that things aren't exactly right with the credit card industry, that we're being gouged, that there's usury, the unreasonable exacting of credit from credit card holders, that essentially it's the ultra-wealthy lending money to the middle class and the working class. Joining me to discuss more of this is Danny Schechter. He's been on the show any number of times. It's Danny Schechter, the News Dissector, and he's director of the film In Debt We Trust. That's when we spoke to him last. He's also the author of the book Plunder, and he's the editor of MediaChannel.org. He recently wrote the piece American Expression, Card Companies Resisting Reforms, and it's a pleasure to welcome back, as always, in New York City in his office, Danny Schechter. Hey, Danny, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be with you. You forgot one little detail. I am the former assistant to the mayor of Detroit, Michigan, none other than the late Honorable Jerome P. Kavanaugh. I, of course, was actually not an assistant in formal, you know, in a formal way. I was an intern in the era when interns didn't have those other connotations that they have now. And I was part of a program of young people who were, you know, then worked, you know, in college, who were working in the offices of mayors and governors. And one of the other interns, if you can believe it or not, in the program that I was in was a guy by the name of, get this, Richard P. Cheney. That's right. Dick Cheney and I were in the same program, and I remember spending a weekend with him at Ohio State University in a high argument. You know, he hasn't changed, and I guess I haven't either.
Well, okay. Danny Schechter, as we record this on Wednesday, May 20th, this just came across Yahoo News. The credit card companies seem to have few friends on Capitol Hill these days, and this has to do with the fact that the Senate just passed this credit card reform bill 90-5, but the credit card companies seem to have few friends on Capitol Hill these days. This hasn't always been the case, has it?
Well, it hasn't been the case. I mean, there have been attempts to try to reform credit card practices for years that have been bottled up, you know, in Congress, resisted by the banks, resisted, you know, by the lobbying organizations who fought it tooth and nail. And you know, as they did, the practices got worse. The gouging got more extreme, and the American people lost more and more money. Now we have a situation where, although most people don't realize this, 77% of the industry is controlled by four banks, Capital One, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and Bank of America. And not only do these companies get money from the TARP program as part of the bailout, taxpayer money, but the credit card companies, American Express, the issuers, American Express and Visa, MasterCard, were allowed, to Discover, to reorganize themselves as bank-holding companies, and they qualified for billions of dollars. And all of this was done in the name of making credit more available to the American people in this credit crunch, in the squeeze that we're in, the crisis. And what happened was the exact opposite. They made credit less available and are continuing to dump people from the rolls, people who have only been paying, let's say, their minimums, and they're making it harder and harder for people. And they've raised their rates, they've raised their interest, they've raised their fees. So all of this is, you know, part of the, you know, problem with the credit card industry.
Well, if you link this up, of course, to the so-called bankruptcy reform bill, it makes it harder and harder for people to declare personal bankruptcy, and the credit card companies had a hand in this, didn't they?
You know, they absolutely did. They lobbied for it. No, in my film, In Debt We Trust, I show that $151 million was raised to lobby against, for bankruptcy reform. That's what they were calling it. It was actually a way to make it harder for Americans to get protection under the bankruptcy law, which was something that we've had in this country since the 1850s. You know, and they demonized people seeking bankruptcy protection, which is really a second chance. So, you know, this has been the problem all along, and a difficult one at that. Hold on a second.
Well,
I have like eight people screaming in the hall.
Well, that's all right. We don't edit here, so this is going to be on our recording. Dan Schechter is my guest. He's the editor of MediaChannel.org, where we're talking about credit card debt. Now, you mentioned about demonizing people that aren't able to pay their credit cards, and the idea is that these were profligate spenders, that they went over their head buying trinkets and electronics and cars they couldn't afford and everything else under the sun. And in some sectors, there's little concern or compassion for the people that are, quote, maxed out on their credit cards.
You know, blame the people is an old, and familiar refrain, particularly among corporations who don't want to have their own responsibility be known, don't want to be accountable, don't want to be transparent. So it's much easier to turn the tables and find somebody who, a person to symbolize and demonize. You remember Ronald Reagan and the welfare queens, poor people in America were reduced to a stereotype. There was often a racist stereotype of, poor black people buying Cadillacs who were, to blame for their own situation. You know, since the late 70s in America, wages have not kept up with, the standard of living. And so actually companies held, wages down. And so a lot of people had to supplement, their income with credit cards, with credit, because that was the only way they could manage to, get by. And also, this was a culture that had shifted from a production-based economy to a consumption-based economy. So instead of the factory, as people in Michigan know all too well, you had the mall as the symbol of American economic power. And as a result of all of that, the shop until you drop mantra was being endorsed by everyone. That's what President Bush said right after 9/11. It's time to go shopping again. I mean, this was, and of course, we have in America, television is a marketing machine. That's what it exists to do, to advertise, to get us, to stimulate us to buy things. And, it's not surprising that people do, because they're bombarded with advertising of, the good life is equated with material goods.
Well, you were so prescient and critical of the practices of the credit card companies. Now there is the credit card reform bill. Does it meet your criteria for what's needed?
Well, I mean, first of all, the good news is it was passed by 90-5. I mean, in this era of partisan wars, and the Republicans were opposing every suggestion, every proposal by the Obama administration, for a bill to pass 90-5 in the Senate shows how partisanship had nothing to do with this. Republicans were hurting too. That everybody felt demonized. The people, three of the senators were just hardcore, right-wing revanchists, and two of them are from South Dakota, which is where all the credit card companies were based, along with Delaware, Vice President Biden's home state. So they, of course, stood up for their local interests. But, most of the people, a wide majority, are opposing this because it's so egregious. Now, the problem is with the bill is that the bill does not go into effect right away. It goes into effect in a year. And today in Congress, there was a meeting of the House and Senate conferees to try to agree on one text. And so I don't know if the pressure to move it up and make it effective immediately has come into effect or not. As we speak, I just don't know.
Well, a lot of people have said the next bubble to birth will be the credit card bubble, and that's directly connected to the banks that we've been bailing out, as you mentioned, Big Four.
Well, another problem with this bill is there's no cap on interest rates or fees. Going back to the Bible, we've had, admonitions against usury. Extortionate interest has always been seen as a bad thing. But under the credit card system, they were basically able to bump up their charges. Now, people who are reformers are fighting to cap it at 36%, which is itself obscene,
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, in some cases, payday lenders were charging as much as 400% interest. So the first people who got relief were people in the military, because, you know, they could say, well, these are support our soldiers kind of thing.
Dan Shaker, let me interrupt you, because someone might have said 400%. Come on, that sounds absolutely preposterous. How could that be? I mean, that's as bad or worse than the mafia. Well, how did somebody wind up with a 400%?
You couldn't get away with that. I mean, this was, you know, they justified it. These were short-term loans, et cetera, these, get money up front to pay your income taxes, these income tax refund loans, all of this from H&R Block and other companies. This is all in my film. And, you know, behind the practices, people funding all of this were big banks like HSBC, in the end, many of these banks themselves were engaging in so much irresponsible and predatory lending practices that they themselves had to write down billions of dollars in loans and barely solvent, and had to come and bail them out. So, you know, all of this, you know, is part of not just a financial story, but a crime story. Criminal practices, people actually conspiring, getting together, figuring out how can we soak the public as much as we can. You know, at the same time, advertising, you know, priceless campaigns, American Express ads everywhere, funding the Tribeca Film Festival and this place and that place, projecting an image of a benevolent company, you know, that really cares about people. Meanwhile, their practices were gouging people. And, you know, this has been contributing to the absolute, difficulties that so many Americans are having. I mean, you take, and then suddenly the jobs go away, and what do you have left? People are left with bills they can't afford to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been 36 million American families have maxed out on their credit cards. I mean, 36 million. We're talking about a growth, $100 million or more in defaults on credit cards. So in other words, the companies gave money to people they knew couldn't afford to pay for it, but they wanted to keep them dependent. You know, it's almost like a return, going from capitalism back to feudalism. They became almost like serfs, you know. They were dependent, you know, on these loans. College students in situations were paying exorbitant amounts of money for loans. Meanwhile, the banks, thanks to the government and the Federal Reserve Bank, were paying only 1% or less on their money. And then they were turning around and charging 9%, 10%, 14%, 24%, 29%, 36%. It's outrageous, okay? And this is because we live in a country that's been financialized. I think a lot of people in Michigan who are, of course, dealing with the closings of the auto companies, the bankruptcy of Chrysler, the impending bankruptcy of General Motors, may not be aware of what's behind a lot of this. What's behind it, in part, has been a change in our economy so that financial institutions and credit institutions became the dominant players, you know, in our economic life. And
rather than manufacturers.
Right. So right. GM was making more money on GMAC for a period of time there. And what was GMAC doing? You think, well, it's giving loans to people to buy cars. No. They were doing that, but they were also giving out a lot of subprime loans to people to buy homes. And so the foreclosure crisis that we're also seeing now, over 10 million families facing foreclosure, is also tied to these irresponsible lending practices. 60% of the people who got subprime loans would qualify for prime loans. But subprime loans made more money for the people making the loans, so they were steered in that direction, just as students were steered, often by financial aid offices at their own universities, to the more expensive loans rather than the government-supported loans. So we've had a pattern here of irresponsible lending, really criminal lending practices, because a lot of this subprime lending is discriminatory, racially and economically, of course, and it's also, it involves a tremendous amount of misrepresentation. The FBI says there's been an epidemic of fraud in mortgage industry. And so, you know, at the core of all this, when you get right down to it, you have crime. And that has not really been exposed by our media. You know, we hear read about, you know, Bernie Madoff or this guy or that, but they're always sort of the exception rather than the pattern of what's actually happened here. And this just needs to be investigated. I wrote a book called Plunder, Investigating Our Economic Calamity. It's at Amazon.com for anyone interested. You know, and it came out, you know, a month before Lehman Brothers fell. So, you know, I sort of saw this coming and show how all of this happened, which most people don't really sort of get or understand because the media has just done such a miserable job of reporting on this and warning us about it. They've been a lapdog, not a watchdog.
Yeah.
So, you know, anyway, am I rambling on too much here, Peter?
Well, I was going to say, you're rambling on, but not too much, because I was going to say, they don't call Danny Schechter the news dissector for nothing. Because, you know, you hit on something that was sort of beginning to percolate in my mind as I was reading the business section of the New York Times today, that increasingly the front page news, when it's not about another economic problem, it's about indictments, that it's almost like our economic system at the upper levels has become eligible for RICO indictments. Is that it's an ongoing criminal conspiracy? I'm not trying to say that everyone is, or 50% or 60%, but enough that it so distorts the nature of economic activity and the quality of life that we ought to be looking at major changes. And you know, we actually did get far afield from what I was asking you about the bill. This credit card bill that's passing the Senate, and whether you thought it met a muster. 36% as a cap on interest rate seems pretty high.
Well, it's not even there yet. I mean, this is what they're fighting for. There's a separate bill. Senator Durbin is supporting it. Bernie Sanders is supporting it to try to roll back and cap interest rates. That's not part of this bill. So there are a lot of flaws in this bill. I mean, it's done some good things. It gives people more warnings when there are changes in their interest rates. It restricts certain practices like universal default. That's when, you know, if you run behind in one card and you get that will go into your credit record, and then all of your cards will go up in your interest rate. So they consider it you've defaulted on everything. When you might, in fact, be having a dispute with a particular person who's overcharging you for something, you challenge it, but it gets on your credit record, then try to get it off. It's hard. So, you know, this is one of the issues here. Obama just yesterday said we need a financial regulator and a new post, in a sense, to regulate these practices, because a lot of one of the things that happened with the Bush administration, it started earlier, but, you know, culminated in a lack of regulation. Regulators looking the other way, not enforcing laws, not forcing the disclosure. Instead of prosecuting somebody, they fine them in a way so they could just write it off as a cost of doing business. So, you know, we've had a situation of complicity with criminality, complicity with large corporations that have been gouging the public. And, you know, you saw what happened with, you know, with Chrysler. Here we had, you know, a private equity company that's never been in the auto business suddenly gets involved in the company. And, you know, its own financing is shaky, to say the least, okay? And, you know, so now they've been forced into bankruptcy. But, you know, a lot of people said, oh, this is great. It's a way to save the auto industry. Look what we're doing to save the auto industry. Instead, what seems to be happening is factories are closing and jobs are disappearing, and along with the dealers and everybody else. And it's being done in a horrible way. I mean, John Stewart had a segment, which I show in my blog today on mediachannel.org, you know, where Chrysler dealers who've been in business for 50 or more years, you know, got a letter in the mail. You know, nobody called them. Nobody even talked to them about it. They were just treated like they were cattle and dirt. And these are the people who were the economic engine of selling cars, you know, that kept, the industry alive. And so, you know, this is, you know, I as I mentioned before, I worked in Detroit in the 60s, you know. I came back maybe a year ago, and, you know, drove all over the east side of Detroit. It looks like Berlin after the war. Mm. I mean, you know, it still hasn't come back after, you know, the riots, of course, in 67. But, it, you know, it's still... you know, a disaster. So what do you have in Detroit? What's generating income? Gambling casinos. And what are the gambling casinos doing? The gambling casinos are you know, again, you know, there to basically part you from your money. And everybody goes thinking they're going to win, and only very few do.
Well, I think with the importance of reform around credit cards, some of which are contained in this bill, maybe others in the Durbin and Sanders bill that would limit credit or interest rates even more. But I think this all has to be tied back, and you made the point earlier, Danny Schechter, that when you have a picture of stagnant wages, you may still have enormous numbers of Americans strung out on credit, albeit at better rates and with fairer practices, but still not making enough to fuel their lives.
Malcolm X used to say, you know, he said, you know, what you want to do is you want to, the knife is in my back and you want to take it out an inch, you know, leave it there. You know, debt dependency is a massive problem, and this bill is unlikely to in any way solve that problem for a lot of people, unfortunately. So, you know, we do have to take more responsibility for what we buy. We do have to, you know, re-examine this kind of material, you know, product-based culture where you have to have the latest and the greatest of everything and shop till you drop. We have to, you know, restore a little bit of sanity to our lives. You know, people are losing their homes. You know, in Detroit they call it, you know, the brown lawn problem, you know, because when a house has been foreclosed on, you know, you see there's a brown lawn, nobody's taking care of it, and suddenly the house next door loses value, that goes into foreclosure, there goes the neighborhood, and there goes all the institutions in the neighborhood. And so you have, you know, what we talk about in international terms, a failed state. You have, you know, a failed city. And, you know, and that's being allowed to happen because of the stranglehold these financial institutions had without any responsibility, any regulation, anybody, you know, kind of holding them to a ethical and legal standard.
Right.
So this is a problem, and, you know, folks, it's not going to get any better unless we wake up and deal with it and challenge it. And I have to say that the unions also, you know, were very quiet on this. You know why? Because there's a union credit card that a lot of unions issue, okay, to their members, and the fees from those cards have been basically substituting for the fact that a lot of, you know, the union memberships have been cut way back because of job losses and because of fights unions have had to try to, you know, still be able to organize and the like, and they've become dependent to some degree on credit cards, so they weren't the most outspoken about the need for economic justice here for many years as well, because they were part, you know, got integrated into the system. So, you know, we all have some measure of responsibility for this, not in the way that they say, well, you know, it's the people, blame the people, but we have to not just blame ourselves, but challenge ourselves. How can we get involved in this issue and do something about it? I mean, my film, In Debt We Trust, you know, lawyers organization called me up from Detroit. They wanted to do a screening, never followed up. You know, there are tools. I mean, this film is a good way to educate people. There are books. You know, there's all kinds of things that we can organize around. But it's not going to happen unless people take some action instead of just being passive in the destruction of their lifestyles and the destruction of their neighborhoods and, you know, and their worlds. We have to stand up and fight against this. And this is, you know, a battle now has been joined, you know, with Wall Street, with, you know, corporate interests that are showing just how uncaring they are.
You know, Danny Schechter, you hit a key word there about people have to start taking responsibility for all that. Most of us are hoping. In fact, in many ways, I don't like that idea of the audacity of hope, because what we're doing is we're hoping that a bunch of politicians will take care of our business better than the last bad crop of politicians that got us into this mess. But small things can begin. I mean, if you're not connected to it, I'm talking to the listeners now, connected to an organization that is involved in these activities, or if you are, you can do things like show Danny Schechter's film In Debt We Trust, and it's two things go on here.
InDebtWeTrust.com. I mean, today, front page Wall Street Journal, we're talking now, you know, on Wednesday, so this program will, but you know, there's a front page article about NACA, a guy named Bruce Marks, who runs an organization called the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, and they're sort of putting him down as a kind of a terrorist, and he's yelling at the banks, and he's, you know, not polite, and he's not nice, and all of this sort of stuff. And, you know, but he's fighting for, to protect homeowners, and he's had some success doing it. I mean, we've got to take the gloves off here a little bit, you know, and this is one of the problems. You know, we had a situation where labor and management became good buddies and friends and everything else, and the consequence of that, in many cases, was more collaboration, you know, than advocacy.
Well, and we've had the situation, of course, where they've had the gloves off for a long time. We're absolutely out of time, and there's so much more from Danny Schechter, the News Dissector. You can go to newsdissector.com and look at Danny Schechter's blog. Go to mediachannel.org. It's kind of film. Get it. Show it in your neighborhood. Show it in your church. Show it at your labor union. It also means people are getting together. Danny Schechter, the director of the film In Debt We Trust, also the book Plunder. And Danny Schechter, as usual, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
On your Apple iPhone, Blue G, get the iTunes Store. Download the free WRIF app. Connect with just one touch and listen to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Is it wrong? I was totally aroused by that.
Details at WRIF.com from 101.
Prices assume 5% down payment at 7.5% APR over 30 years.
Wow, look at this place. 4 bedrooms, 2 baths.
Yeah, I know.
Jeez, you're not even 30. We have the same salary, Maggie. How can you afford all this?
My mortgage payment is less than $300 a month.
What? That's less than I pay for rent. How did you...
All I did was call BNI for a list of homes that are being sold for back taxes or foreclosure.
Home foreclosures are on the rise. That means there are great deals out there, especially for first-time home buyers. Like this listing, a 4-bedroom, 2-bath going for under $20,000. That's just $199 a month. Listings go fast, so call BNI for a list of these homes today. Call 1-800-497-5930.
I could actually afford to own my own home.
Yeah, and it's easy. Just call BNI for the list.
Properties that have been foreclosed or repossessed are a real bargain and sometimes sell for little money down. For a list of homes in your area, call 1-800-497-5930. 1-800-497-5930. That's 1-800-497-5930.
If your home still has old leaky windows, you know what that does to your energy bills. That's why now is a great time to replace them with custom replacement windows from Sears. Just go to greatwindowsnow.com, schedule a free in-home estimate, and you can save $375. Custom replacement windows from Sears glide smoothly, tilt in for easy cleaning, and may help reduce your energy costs. And if you act now, you may qualify for a federal tax credit worth up to $1,500. Just go to greatwindowsnow.com or click the Sears banner on your screen. You can save $375 and get a big tax credit, too. Offer ends June 30th. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. Licensee information available upon request. Replace your old windows and save energy and money. Just click the Sears banner on your screen or visit greatwindowsnow.com. Greatwindowsnow.com. That's greatwindowsnow.com.
This chance to win the Ultimate NASCAR Experience could come at any time. Listen for your chance to win and get more details at WRIF.com.
like a soldier.